It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. I know it's going to be a long one because I've got one of the best panels ever. Paris Martineau, Glenn Fleischman, and Dan Morin. Of course, we're going to talk about the upcoming Apple event and what to expect. And then a very deep conversation about AI art. Is it legit? And a doctor who used his truck to perform a vasectomy. It's not what you think. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 891, recorded Sunday, September 4th, 2022. Use the Rivian? That's nuts. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Podium. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/twit. And by ClickUp, the productivity platform that'll save you one day a week on work guaranteed. Use the code TWIT to get 15% off ClickUp's massive unlimited plan for a year, meaning you can start reclaiming your time for under $5 a month. Sign up today at clickup.com, but hurry, this offer ends soon. And by Zapier. Zapier makes it easy to connect all your apps, automate routine tasks, and streamline your processes. Try Zapier for free today at zapier.com/twit. And by Stamps.com. Get ahead of the holiday chaos this year. Sign up at Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the page, enter the code TWIT, and you'll get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a digital scale. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we talk about the week's tech news. And, you know, sometimes we put shows together with great thought, and we really, you know, kind of balance it. Sometimes we just throw the names in the air and they come down. And sometimes that's better. This is one of those, maybe, I don't know, maybe Jason Howell had an idea, but I am thrilled by this panel. Let's say hi to Paris Martineau. She was a reporter for The Information. Always great to see her. Very crafty. Today, no sequined, no bejeweled mannequins in the background.
I'm going to, I'll move it in frame at
That's
the break.
Okay.
Just wait. I'm going to keep people on their toes, you know.
I bet you,
have
though.
A kind of shifting tableau.
The rest of the panel will recognize something right behind you. And let's find out when we ask, when we say hello to, Glenn Fleischman. I think I recognize the chuckle from Glenn.fun, longtime reporter for a variety of Macintosh magazines, former Jeopardy contestant, type historian. Hello, Glenn.
Hello. Do I recognize a... I see the transparent speaker. I've forgotten the exact name of it. Is that an original...
It was Harman Kardon.
Harman Kardon soundsticks?
Yes.
I picked
like
them up from...
That's 20 years old?
They are, and yet they sound fantastic, and they look very
cool.
I've them connected to a record player in a fun little mishmash of technology there.
Is there a person standing behind those Harman Kardon sticks?
There is. That is a lamp shaped like a man with a uniquely placed light switch that I will leave to your hand.
Did you make that?
I did not, but I bought it from a vintage dealer who
Excellent.
I really enjoy.
And every time you flip it on, you just go...
Every time I flip it on, you know. I'll often have people come over and they'll be like, so where's the light switch? And I'm like, guys, there's only one thing
there's
on here.
There's only one place to look. Wow, that's hysterical.
Fragile?
Also with us, great to have Dan Morin. This is, I think, one of the first things you've done off your paternity leave. Is that right?
You are my first stop on the return for my paternity leave. There you go.
Six Colors co-editor with Jason Snell. He has been off for a couple of months with a brand new baby. How old's the baby?
Baby's about 6 weeks old.
Oh, so it's not even a couple of months.
No.
How's it been?
It's been tiring. I need a better camera that doesn't show you the bags under my eyes. But other than that, it's been wonderful.
I love it. Well, I hope even if you're on paternity leave, you write because... We are waiting for Volume 4 of the Galactic Cold War saga. I have here, you thankfully sent me the latest volume, which is book three, The Nova Incident. Three of them. By the way, really good. You know, I'll be honest. This is terrible to say, but I wasn't expecting much.
Okay. That's good. Yeah. I like to have a low bar.
Leo, you're starting off absolutely brutal.
Let me explain.
You were just at a really low bar.
Not in any way a reflection on you, Dan. It's just that I know quite a few people in our business. You know, that's the old canard. Everybody's got a novel in their desk drawer. Mm-hmm. And the few people I know who have released those novels probably should not have. But now, did you start as a writer and then, you know, as a sci-fi writer and then become a tech writer?
It was always a passion of mine. And I got out of college and didn't really know what I was doing. And I worked IT for a while. And then I started writing professionally. And once I had done that, I think it really helped me hone a lot of stuff about my fiction. So I kind of went back to it after spending my first couple of years in tech journalism because it felt like, oh, you know, now I kind of understand. I work with deadlines and I've had to do this regularly and put in all these hours. And you can't help but get better, I think, at those kinds of tasks if you do them enough. So I think they kind of worked together nicely.
Well, and that's what I look for in a good novelist, somebody who makes deadlines. So,
hey, it's harder than you think.
No,
right?
Hey, just ask George R. R. Martin, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That guy's really suffering for not making a deadline. Let me tell you,
Patrick Rothfuss. You know, there are quite a few in the in our
Dan was the person I thought most likely to become a breakout science fiction author bestseller, and I think you're well on the way to doing that.
No,
I
remember reading
was it the beta edition of the Caledonian Gambit? I think I read pre-release, and I was like,
yes,
this is some fine work. And then I read the release version, and I'm like, man, this guy also revises, which is incredible. I mean, I like the draft, and then the release version was fantastic.
But there's a somewhat of a leap from nonfiction writing to fiction writing. And not everybody can make that leap. Some have fallen in the crevasse in between. So I just wanted to say it's really good. And everybody should, if you like sci-fi, this is it. The Galactic Cold War Saga. And you've told me that there may be a fourth one in the works.
Yeah, I'd like to. I've been working on this long overarching sort of plot line, and I am hoping I get a chance to sort of bring that to fruition. But I will say, like, you know, a lot of people don't like to pick up a series unless it's done, but I tried to also structure it so that each of the books tells like a standalone story in its own regard as well, but like in the background, right, there's like an overarching plot that's developing slowly. So I think you can still get a lot of enjoyment out of the individual volumes as it goes along. Without worrying too much about, like, oh no, will the series ever be finished?
You also have the best publisher ever, Angry Robot. I just love that.
That's true. Yeah.
Hey, so long as you finish the series within 30 years, you'll have a leg up on R.R. Martin.
If they start shooting a season one of your show, let's say you have 5 years to get the last book done.
That's good. That's
or
a comfortable,
at least
right?
The next book done. You know, it doesn't even have to be the last book. Right. Can just be a edition.
Got to stay far enough ahead of the game there.
Yeah. Or you could do like the Wheel of Time and just die before you're done.
Yeah, have you considered that? You know, Leo has
one way to avoid deadlines.
I just had a kid. Come on, I'm already feeling the mortality. I don't need a little more of that.
Important part
this is
of
very
deadlines.
Spicy Leo today. you could die. I don't know about these folks. Man.
Get to know Brandon Sanderson ahead of time, and you'll be set.
I will tell you, I know. I actually have met Brandon because we have the same agent.
Ah, well,
I know him.
Robert Jordan was very lucky because he passed away before finishing this. How many 14 book series?
17.
It's ridiculous.
Maybe 14. It's a
insane.
Lot.
Insane. Yeah. And of course, he died before finishing it. It's pretty clear. He was going to just keep writing until he died. Thank God he had Brandon Sanderson to come along and finish it and finish it in high style. Yeah. Of all of the TV productions, though, the Wheel of Time TV show is the worst.
I don't know. There are some pretty bad TV productions.
But I mean, out of classic science fiction, I guess I should say. Yeah.
I don't have anything. I have no loyalty to the book series. I hadn't read it. I kind of like Wheel of Time.
See, that's pretty much how it works. If you've read it, you'll hate it. And if you've never read it, you'll like the TV show. And it is better now that I think of it than Foundation, which truly awful.
I had so much hope for it, and then by the end, it's like, what are you doing?
Horrible!
Oh, come on,
horrible!
But I don't know. I don't know what they were doing.
How about Lord of the Rings? Are we liking Lord of the Rings?
I'm waiting to ask Glenn about Lord of the Rings. Glenn is a big Lord of the Rings fan.
I'm sitting here with my 15-year-old who has not read Lord of the Rings, and I'm like, oh, well, they're not telling a story about Fëanor, the creator of the Silmarils, and his original name was Mel, and I'm like, oh, my God, I don't remember that I know all this stuff. Why do I know all this stuff? It's the second age.
All the useful information
like
you had to
every useful thing you've forgotten, it's just taken up by names of elves.
And Silmarils. It's not which Finrod was, but Celebrimbor was the friend of the dwarf. I'm a little confused.
Have they? It's only been two episodes. Have they botched the series yet, or is it pretty much faithful to what little we know?
I think they're doing an incredibly good job of trying to bring in new people without 100% offending people.
Yeah.
Like I was 30 years ago.
Did not specify a lot of this stuff. For instance, and I saw somebody note this, and I don't think this is a spoiler, but they're sailing the ship into the Grey Havens. Our princess, I won't say names, our princess has been awarded release into the Grey Havens. She's on the ship. They're standing there, the warriors, long voyage, I think, but they're standing there the whole time in their armor. Then these maidens come out and help undress them.
Yes, yes.
So here's my question. are the maidens are they gonna sail the ship back for the next trip, or are they going into the Grey Havens?
I think it's a one-use ship. It feels like
it's not going to survive.
Doesn't seem like it's turning around again.
Yeah.
Where are those maidens going? They got all this extra garb.
There's some people who can go, but so there's these different order of celestial beings.
The servants take the wet weapons and the armor from the elves and they throw them on the ground. They don't like fold them up, put them away. They just go here. I mean,
it's like, what were you doing? Couldn't they have just done that? Couldn't they just take off their own armor?
They sell them for scrap later on. They can repurpose it and recycle, put a little bit.
Because they've got to get another boat to get back.
Okay.
That's right.
In Wings of Desire. The armor thing's in Wings of Desire, right? So this all connects up to the Peter Falk universe.
It all comes back to Wim Wenders in the end.
Wim Wenders.
How about the House of the Dragon? Are we happy with the House of the Dragon?
I watched the first one and thought it was better than I expected it was going to be. I was not super invested, but my wife was actually like, oh, I really like to watch this. I'm like, all right, we'll sit down and watch it. And I don't know. I thought it was interesting. Having felt like the Game of Thrones show ended on pretty sour note for me, I was more than pleasantly surprised by this and having a little more, I thought like having the positioning the female character with a little more agency and making a more involved story and like sort of focusing in a bit too, right? Like rather than having like there's a 6 million characters and they're all over this continent. Instead, it's like a smaller group and yeah, I don't know, we'll see where it goes. I'll watch the next few.
I feel like Glenn, you're a little bruised still from season 8 of the Game of Thrones.
I've never seen a single episode or a portion of that Thrones show. It didn't strike me as I'd read George R. R. Martin before he started writing that series, and I liked some of his earlier, funnier stuff better.
Before he was cool.
I'm
starting the show with some light material because we're gonna get pretty heavy right off the bat. We talked about this on Wednesday with our wonderful Mike Masnick from Tech Dirt, who has really kind of burst a socket on this children's online safety bill that was just passed in California. We're waiting for the governor to sign it into law. It seems like a good idea. Who wouldn't want to protect children online? And of course, if you're not in California, you're probably thinking you can take the Rod Pyle Lower Third Town. I don't know why that's there. But there is no Rod Pyle in this story whatsoever. Oh my God!
I mean,
what's
that's the New York
on?
Times,
have
baby.
Have you lost control? I think he's lost control of the lower third.
Wheel that
the lower
back
thirds
to the,
have become sentient.
As you say, Leo, all of your smart assistants have taken over the show. So
scrub the launch. Scrub the launch.
Yeah, that was the Artemis story. That'll be coming later. None of you are in California, right, Dan? Are you in California? I can't remember where you are, Dan.
Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. That's why your window is open. If you were in California, you would be hunkered down now. It's about 109 degrees outside.
Oh, yeah. And you guys don't believe in air conditioning, right?
Yeah, that's the funny thing is people in California say, well, we have natural air conditioning until it gets hot and then...
I was going to say.
We don't.
They don't say much of anything.
Climate change might change that for you.
Yeah. So this is maybe not on your radar, but it sure is for us in California. And Mike Masnick was also in California. The New York Times story about this, you would never, you know, think there was a problem. The California Age Appropriate Design Code Act requires any website, unlike COPPA, where it only affects websites that are aimed at children. This is a website, any website that might have somebody under 18 visited, which I think is any website. Certainly ours, certainly Mike Masnick's. So if you have the potential that somebody under 18 might visit your website, then you are required to, first of all, know the age of everybody who visits your website. Problem number one, that's pretty intrusive. We don't know the age of anybody who listens to our shows or visits our website. I don't want to know their age, but in order to enforce this law, I need to. In fact, Mike's concern was, am I going to have to do age verification? And if I do, how am I going to do that? He says, it may be face ID. You may have to start, because you've got to know how old these people are. Then you have to look at every single feature of your site and do what they call a DPIA, kind of like an environmental impact report on each feature of your site and how it might infect people under 18. And that has to be, you have to do it because it has to be available should the Attorney General of California ask. You have 72 hours to produce that.
Yeah, this surely feels like the kinds of rules that go into effect in countries that are trying to prohibit speech or use workarounds. Like, you know, India has imposed laws and, you know, Russia has imposed more draconian ones. And even India, ostensibly a democracy, has imposed laws that restrict freedom in the name of safety or freedom from libel or other things. And they're meant to chill speech. And this isn't per se designed that way, but it has all the hallmarks of one. It's expensive or impossible to implement. It's probably, I'm not a lawyer, it's probably unconstitutional based on what I'm reading. Does not seem to fit within the permissibility of how this could possibly be enforced. So the burden is undue and it's chilling of speech. And so you're kind of like, well, how did it get this far? I think Mike pointed out in his article, like, well, nobody wants to, you know, you were saying, you know, oh, no, I'm opposed to protecting children online.
Yeah.
Just clip that out, what I just said, right?
Yeah.
Glenn Fleischman is opposed, you know, I'm not, but no one's going to vote. No politician is going to say, I'm voting against the protecting children from terrible things online bill.
Exactly.
It's, you know.
Which is why it passed in the Senate 30-0.
Don't we do this every few decades? I mean, I'm remembering when I was a teenager, the Communications Decency Act was the big sort of hot button issue at the time, which, you know, that was the heady days of 1996 or so, right, where the internet was not at all what it is today. But there was still the sort of the same idea, like, oh, we've got to figure out a way to flag stuff that might be objectionable so that people aren't exposed to it. And ultimately, I think it ended up being sort of impossible to deal with, because how do you do that, right? How do you do that on the internet? How do you control for that kind of information if you can't even control for it in, you know, other public sphere spaces? I agree with Glenn, it seems like an unduly onerous task for people who are, you know, otherwise trying to be law-abiding.
Actually, the CDA ended up having a positive impact. Ron Wyden said, you know what, we're going to have to make an exemption here for social media and other sites, and the Section 230 was written, thank goodness. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Paris.
I was saying, I think the thing that sticks out to me is, I mean, how are we expecting all of these different sites or service providers to be able to identify with certainty whether or not the person accessing your website is a child? I mean, obviously, we have currently kind of like tracking tools. You can look at website analytics and see the demographics of your users, but a lot of social media sites and providers generally are kind of making their tools in a way that purposefully ignores anybody who could be under 18, because you don't want to deal with that sort of data. And let's say even if you somehow devised a perfect way to send a flag up when any cell phone owned and operated by someone under 18 accessed your website, that still wouldn't cover situations where, like, most kids are probably using their parents' iPad or parents' phone for these sort of things. It just seems like a very technical question that is being answered by, like, kind of a very vague blanket order.
It's designed to impose enforcement, right? It's designed to be violated unintentionally and easily and thus allow government to intervene.
Yeah, and Mike raises that issue. In fact, he was told, I think, by the sponsors of the bill, well, don't worry, the California Attorney General decides who's prosecuted. And one would, don't worry. And one would hope that the AG would say, well, you know, Twit or TechDirt or the information, yeah, 18-year-olds read it, but it's not, they're not a threat to 18-year-olds. The AG would get to decide, but as Mike points out, well, what if I write an article that's critical of the California Attorney General, which he does a lot, apparently, then what happens? Is it?
What
is
if this law goes to effect in Texas and you write something critical of that Attorney General?
Yeah.
A lot of times cases like this, too, I feel like unduly target, you know, people in community, like such as the LGBTQ communities too, right? Where it's like, well, what is considered objectionable content, right? This is the kind of thing we're running into with the book bannings that are popping up all across the country, is that, you know, you have governments and local, like, you know, city and municipality governments that are like, well, I don't want my kid exposed to this, so I'm going to, you know, try to enforce the local school library to get rid of these books because I just don't agree with them. So who gets to decide, you know, certainly what falls under objectionable content and how exactly that gets protected?
The other weird thing about this bill, it was primarily written by a British baroness, director of one of the Bridget Jones movies, who dropped her Hollywood career to protect children online, she says.
Anytime
that
I hear the words,
where I thought that sentence was going.
that's a weird direction.
Anytime I hear United Kingdom and protect children, I want to run the other direction.
I know.
They're so bad at everything they do there. There's been so many scandals and conflicts. The whole the Jimmy Savile thing with the BBC. I mean, like, large and small, I think the United Kingdom has done a terrible job protecting children from predators online and off, in government, in politics, in entertainment. And you're like, okay, yeah, we really want to follow their lead because they know what's right.
Is this?
I mean, Cory Doctorow has written so effectively about the failures
absolutely.
Of the UK.
Yeah. He lived there for a long time. Is this ignorance on the part of lawmakers? Like, they're meaning, they want to do the right thing, and they just don't understand the impact of what they're doing? Or is it some sort of malevolence? Certainly the baroness seems to have some sort of malevolence against the open internet. Do you think there is a trend? It feels like politicians these days, it's not merely to protect the children. They want to take down big tech. They don't like it.
I mean, something that I think about a lot is, as part of my job and all of our jobs, we end up watching these big tech hearings that we have every couple of months over the last couple of years. And I remember the first couple that I watched, I was like, oh, this is going to be interesting, you know, an actual, like, political discussion about what's going on. Was not that. It is mostly just politicians giving a 1 minute stump speech, totally unhinged or unrelated to the thing they're actually discussing. And I think that's what we're seeing here in some ways, is it is partially ignorance, but partially a lot of, like, modern day politicians have realized that the way to get attention from your base or the sort of people that you want to bring into your base is by making big, bold statements like bringing down tech, you know, making all the children safe, regardless of whether or not that actually has any teeth in it. And the end result of that is sometimes you get policies like this that can have disastrous unintended consequences.
There's both a carrot and a stick. There's the threat, the fear that a soundbite will be used against you. Oh, he's against protecting children online. But there's also the carrot that it makes a great soundbite that might get you some votes if you say, yeah, she voted to protect the kids online. So it's the problem is soundbites. It's just posturing.
There is ignorance at the base of it, too, because I think it also presupposes this fallacy that there is somehow a switch you can flip that will protect, you know, make it the system perfectly functional in a way that protects children, right? Like, we entertain this idea that, like, oh, well, technology can solve this issue for us, right? And that we just, you know, technology is very black and white, one and zero. And it's like, well, you know, it can obviously tell you whether or not you're able to consume this information. But that's, you know, I think as Paris pointed out, it's very difficult to know who is consuming this information. I think also about things like libraries that have, you know, computers available for people to access the internet, who might otherwise not have, you know, ways to do that. How do you tell who's using that, right? Like, how do you tell who's on the other end of that? So I think people think tech is very clear cut when they don't know anything about it. But, you know, anybody who spends time with it realizes, like, no, this is extremely nuanced and there's a lot of gray area.
Well, this brings me back to the whole, well, there's two things. One is the overarching issue is that I think we probably all agree, I won't speak for other people, but I think it's likely that we know that the big social media companies and other companies in most cases are failing to protect children online. They're doing things that are actively bad for children. They don't seem to have any compunction about it, and no one has an idea of precisely how to stop it except through public disclosure, whistleblowing, threats by legislators, but nothing. There's no compulsion, and particularly in countries with expansive free speech laws and commercial speech laws, people feel impotent to solve that problem. So we know there are problems. Instagram used to promote eating disorders, and they've made great strides in that. But, you know, there's just all of this negative content aimed at children, algorithm-fed often, that has some kind of beneficial effect. But it also reminds me, Dan, what you were just saying of when they kept talking about, I think it was the Clinton administration, and later keep trying to bring this up, like, well, what if we had a special key that only law enforcement could access only in very particular cases? Otherwise, the encryption would be perfect and protected. You know, when they're talking about end-to-end encryption, it's like, well, there's no way to build an algorithm like that. And every encryption expert in the world agrees, but nobody on the political side wants to accept that. They don't want to accept the technological problem that you can have a system with a key that only legitimate parties can use. Same thing here is, how do you prevent harm to children, which is active and underway, without also chilling speech? I was terrified for my children as they grew up in this environment. And fortunately, I think we managed to avoid, you know, any significant problems. But I'm sure we all have stories, or know people have stories, of children being, you know, harassed online or singled out or groomed or so forth. It's just a massive problem made worse by many of these companies.
Also, people don't want to hear that the hard solutions to this problem are often ones that require, like, societal change and work rather than just technology, which can solve it at the, you know, snap of your fingers, right? Like, people are like, oh, there's a shortcut. We just make the technology do that, right? And yeah, nobody wants to think about the fact that it's like, no, that's a Band-Aid, and it's not a particularly good one. It's a Band-Aid on a gushing, you know, amputated arm or something. It's not going to fix your problem.
I also wonder if Berenice Kidron, if she used to work in Hollywood, if Hollywood were told, oh, no, you have to make sure that every movie you make is appropriate for somebody under 18, or every novelist had to make sure every novel was appropriate for somebody under 18, I think they would bridle at those kinds of restrictions, sure, as they should. We don't want to design the world for people under 18.
Don't forget Tipper Gore.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, what is appropriate mean in that case even, right? Like, you know, first of all, kids at different ages have different levels of maturity and different levels of appropriateness. A 13-year-old and a 17-year-old are going to have very different levels of what they think is appropriate. I mean, I definitely went to, you know, rated R movies as a 17-year-old, and probably with my parents, you know, went to rated R movies younger if it was like a serious topic or something like that. But yeah, how do you deem what is appropriate?
The ratings actually is a good system, because all the ratings were designed to do is to inform you or parents ahead of time, here's the content, not to censor the content. So I'm not sure I think the ratings kind of worked. I don't know. Would you want to rate every website on the internet and say this website rated R? I don't know if that's appropriate either. Yeah.
Who would do it? I mean, the motion picture. Right. Association of America had a reason to do it. I mean, a lot of organizations, a lot of trade groups grew up specifically to address preventing regulation from going into effect by voluntarily adhering to standards,
right,
and enforcing
the code. And
yeah, right. And so who wants a law? But in this case, I think, you know, how do you protect children? Even from, there's some very coarse things, like, how do you protect predators? There's, you know, I have this discussion a lot. It's not that there are so many predators in the world. I want to believe that the number of people who are pedophiles and active predators against other people is a relatively small percentage of humanity, a very small percentage.
I want to believe that, too. I'm not sure that that's the case, but I want to believe
I don't know either. But let's pretend it's the case briefly, but say that the internet is an amplification force. So it doesn't matter if it's 1 in 100,000 right. people or 1 in 1,000,000 is out after children. If they can access 10 million children and winnow it down and find one near them or that they can reach out to, it's a yield issue. And so online services need to impose their own protections that reduce that yield potential. And that's where I think things are failing, is I don't think they have a motivation to do it. There's no financial benefit. There's no regulatory framework. And they haven't yet suffered significantly from it. So when there's backlash, like there was a lot of backlash against Facebook for all the revelations from, the group in England. Yes, thank you. Right. So they had backlash. It seemed like it affected their market price. There was the threat of a lot of regulation. There were open hearings, right? But I don't think we've seen the same concerted effort that's gone into the sort of diffuse choices that have led to children being endangered. Occasionally something will leap up and Facebook will say, oh, okay, we're going to disable all contents on or comments on videos uploaded by people under 18. Or didn't they just say they're going to make all uploaded videos private by default on YouTube?
Is that it? If you're under 17,
right. So these Band-Aids, but they do it only in response to the most outrageous stuff. So it's possible this law being passed, maybe it gets signed, it's held up instantly in the courts. Obviously, you can imagine every giant tech company files for an injunction, and it takes years to resolve, conceivably.
Can imagine every state legislature, well, at least Texas, Florida, and others, saying, oh, good idea, and passing a similar bill. Which makes it harder.
But with
and harder.
Their own
slant,
like specifications for what is good or bad for children.
Right.
You know, obviously, given what we've seen in Texas, that would probably include a lot of anti-LGBTQ sort of points, as well as, you know, maybe content around women's right to, you know, choose is also considered bad for children. I think it gets really tricky when you are handing over, like, content controls and censorship opportunities to these different state legislatures in such a vague way.
This brings up something, and you added this link to the rundown, Glenn. I wasn't going to talk about it, but I think it's appropriate to talk about it, which is the battle between Cloudflare and Kiwi Farms, which is a horrendous, horrific website. I don't even want to mention the name of, because it's really been used to dox people, to target people, to swat people. By the way, both political persuasions. It's just a nasty, nasty site. Cloudflare was protecting it with their DDoS services. And as recently as a couple of days ago, Matthew Prince said, we are not going to stop protecting them. That's what we do. We don't judge. We just protect these, you know, websites, and everybody has a right to speak. He changed his mind, I think, under incredible pressure. But he says also because we see so many dangerous threats on Kiwi Farms.
I mean, I believe right before Cloudflare ended up making the decision to end its relationship with the website, there had been posts on the forum about people being like, oh, we heard in this podcast that this Twitch streamer was maybe going to go to, I believe it was a poutine place Belfast, and they looked up, put a list of every poutine place in Belfast, and somebody had said, oh, I've planted bombs at three of them. Another one's like, I have men with guns waiting outside of one of them. It escalated dramatically.
This is a Canadian Twitch streamer, Clara Serenity, who actually fled to Ireland to be safe from Kiwi Farms threats, and they just followed her right there.
I mean, because she, I believe, had been swatted multiple times. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She'd been doxxed. Her whole family had been doxxed. It had escalated beyond. I mean, it had escalated and then escalated again and then escalated again. I also think it's interesting that, I mean, the way that Cloudflare came to this decision with regards to saying, no, we're not going to sever this business relationship, again and again, public statements, and then 2 days later deciding to do it after increased pressure, is kind of the exact same way that this broke down, I believe, with 8chan and Daily Stormer.
That's right.
Whenever they kicked them
they resisted
off over
that
the last
too.
Couple of years. Yeah. But and then a couple of days later,
They gave in.
Did it.
I have sympathy for the and this is the reason I bring this up is this is kind of another facet of the same argument, which is how do you do this? Do you allow all speech and you know, let God sort it out? Do you prohibit, do you attempt to lock it down to protect everybody? Or is there some middle ground? And I don't know if any of those solutions work.
This is one of those places where I feel like I've got like a pet peeve about people who cry censorship at a lot of these things, because, you know, people are like, oh, free speech everywhere and you can have all the speech you want and it doesn't matter, you know. And it's like, well, but these are businesses. This is not the so like what right. we're talking about with this.
Oh, it's not illegal for Cloudflare to block them or not block them. Yeah,
they can decide who they want to do business with. Yeah. People used to, when I worked back in Macworld, you know, people would complain on our forums all the time that censorship and like Threads got shut down and whatever. It's like, whatever, we're a business. We get to choose.
It's only censorship if the government does it.
Yeah. This is my exact response with everybody complaining about losing their Twitter accounts. I'm like, you're not being censored. That's a business.
That's not what this is. Right. That's capitalism, people. That is what you signed up for. That's
this is the free market.
We never see this with like, you know, we never see this with like Cloudflare standing up for this LGBTQ site that expresses extreme inclusiveness to an extent that bigots all over the world are so angry they're demanding Cloudflare drop it, even though the site is engaged in peaceful posting of articles about drag queens reading at libraries and people getting married around the world and the increase in inclusive, non-toxic environments. So, like, you don't see Cloudflare out there because it's always violence. It's always the right wing. It's always, you know, fascism or flirting or way over the line.
Although,
anti-Semitism.
Kiwi Farms was used to SWAT Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah, I feel like equal opportunity.
I mean,
employers
swatting
there.
Anybody, bad idea.
Bad.
I'll even, yeah, this is like, my one chance. I'll come for Marjorie Taylor Greene. Yeah. Shouldn't be swatted.
Bad.
No one should be swatted.
No.
It's fascinating because it's all these people, you know, this is where you get back into the whole most terrorism seems to arise out of domestic terrorism, as in domestic in the house. You find most of the people who get involved in these kinds of efforts have trouble already that's well known. They already commit or are victims of domestic partner or familial violence. And so you keep seeing these things writ large. So it's like they find the weakest target, which right now is trans people remain a vulnerable target worldwide. And they attack them because they feel like they will get the most support from even people who otherwise would be negative. But then, you know, it's always about violence. So they go after Marjorie Taylor Greene for who knows what reason. Totally unacceptable that they would do this, put her family at risk, whatever you think about her, obviously. But they don't have any discrimination. So you think, I always go back to that. Like, they came for, you know, they come for one group first, but they're always going to come for another, another, another. And you're always going to be in one of those groups.
It's the means that's the issue more than anything, right? It's not. It's how they're going about it, right? I mean, I think about this too when I see stuff in the politics realm where people are like, oh, if this happens, there'll be violence in the street. And again, to Glenn's point, you never hear the people who are about inclusiveness and diversity being like, oh, there'll be violence in the street if there's not inclusion and diversity. No, that's not how it works. So yeah, it's about the means of how you're going about. I have a friend who has actually been targeting by these kinds of people, and it is truly horrific, the kind of things that they have done, you know, in order to try and basically just shut these people up and harass them into silence, like, or for often for very little provocation at all, other than they just feel like doing it. So, I don't know. I'm glad that Cloudflare made this decision. It's a shame it took them so long, and it's, you know, not going to solve the problem, but it's a step in the right direction.
The thing I've seen said, which I think is worth repeating, is that freedom of speech, freedom of expression can be suppressed by people who are also engaging in freedom of expression. So when Cloudflare says we're about, you know, maximalist free speech, we don't want to suppress anybody because then governments come to us and tell us to take human rights groups off the internet, which to me seems like a specious argument to begin with. There's a bright light difference.
You can make that groups decision.
Like if a group's advocating violence and doxing people and involved in the coordination of harassment and abuse, that's quite different than a group saying this government's committing, you know, human rights violations. But the fact is, these groups that commit harassment are decreasing the amount of freedom of speech of other people. And I think there has to be a balance when you're dealing with extremists. You can say, like, some people are never going to like trans people. They're never like the concept that Jewish people exist or whatever. And I mean, I would say I can live with that. I won't try to live with that. But it's like I accept that people may have bigoted ideas or terrible ideas that affect me and my family and my community, my country, whatever. I can accept that, but facilitating them to coordinate activities that are intended to suppress speech and harm lives, that is a very bright line. And it suppresses my ability, expresses everyone around me's ability to be able to have their own version of free speech.
To Glenn's point, when I was in college, one of the jobs I had was during, in subsequent years after I was a freshman, I was in an orientation group where we taught incoming students about using all the tech systems at our school, right? We said, here's how you use your email, whatever. And we went over free speech, hate speech, and harassment. And this was in like 1999 and 2000. And if I could teach hundreds of incoming freshmen the difference, then, you know, we can figure this out.
It seems so difficult, though, to know exactly where the line is drawn. Is violence where the line is drawn?
Violence is certainly one of the lines. I think that it also shouldn't be a terrible thing if you have a group of people where they are actively coordinating to harass others, and you want to actively coordinate a group of people to say, hey, business that's making money from this group, protecting them, we think that's a bad business relationship. You should be allowed to do that. I think that's not a big deal. And if Cloudflare is deeply annoyed and frustrated by it, so be it. You're the one keeping this business relationship going.
The CEO was calling that bullying. The fact that people who are under the gun, being attacked, docs, forced from their homes, people committing self-harm, that people standing up for them against Kiwi Farms and against Cloudflare's relationship was bullying. And that is bullying.
Yeah. Should libs of TikTok be banned? This is a big controversy on Twitter right now. 1.3 million followers. It is not actively inciting violence, although it paints LGBTQ teachers of being pedophiles and groomers.
I mean, I do think it's worth noting that libs of TikTok's content and specific hyper-focus on children's hospitals that also treat trans children resulted in bomb threats being called to children's hospitals.
I want to concur with that. That's Boston Children's Hospital right down the street from me, basically, where I am. And that's a big deal. That is a major hospital that does a lot of important work, including the kinds of things they're getting harassed for. And to, you know, call in a bomb threat on a hospital, clear indication.
Libs of TikTok says we 100% condemn any acts or threats of violence. They are not saying go bomb the hospitals, but...
No, but it's plausible that, you know, will nobody rid me of this troublesome priest is still incitement to violence.
Yeah. There you go.
I mean,
reference there on that one, Glenn Fleischman.
Sorry.
I haven't taken a close look at their tweets as of late. The only tweet I happened to see last night was, I believe, I'm forgetting the woman's name behind the account, but she had tweeted, oh, I'm prepared for Twitter to suspend or block my account. And once they do, I'm going to sue Twitter and everybody there because they're censoring me and taking away my freedom to speech. And I'm like, that's not how any of this works, sweetie. Like, you losing your Twitter account is not a First Amendment violation.
No. Twitter has not banned them as of
yet. No. They suspended them.
I think one slap on the wrist for one tweet, which like everybody else in the world who's gotten one tweet flagged, you delete it and you move on.
Right.
Like Jordan Peterson.
It's it's a difficult thing to know how to do it. It is not deplatforming somebody to kick them off of Twitter. I'm sorry.
A
brief aside, since you mentioned Jordan Peterson, though, I think one of the funniest things is if you look back over all the different times that he's been suspended or something and been like, that's it, I'm done with Twitter. This platform is terrible and I refuse to acknowledge this. Next time they try to suspend one of my tweets, I'm never going to delete it and come back. He says that and then like
every time,
22 hours later, he's back. That man is addicted. He cannot stop.
I got to say, the point of joy I have right now is watching Alex Jones being raked over the coals over and over over and over again, and all of his garbage exposed, and also the success and lack of success of so-called deplatforming, right? So Alex Jones lost his access to a number of platforms, and yet he apparently continues to make tens of millions or more dollars a year from selling snake oil to people. But it's been great to see that grimy underbelly, like fully the rock picked up and exposed, to understand exactly the ecosystem and what the value is to people spreading misinformation and hatred.
This stuff is so hard, though. I mean, I can't really blame Twitter for trying to thread this needle. Mm-hmm. I may disagree with what they've done in some cases and not in others. But it's a hard thing. It is a very hard thing to do. And it's hard to know what the line is, right? Or yeah, wrong.
They also put themselves in that position, though, right? I mean, they opened that can of worms by creating the product that they did. And if you know, to a certain degree, they are responsible for policing it in a responsible manner, right? So on the other one hand, yeah, there is some trickiness to this, but it's a problem that could be, at least if not solved, addressed by prioritizing it. And it always feels like they kind of want to throw up their hands and be like, oh, well, you know, there's nothing we can do.
Right.
You know, we don't make the rules. And you're like,
it's the internet. The main character of the day problem at Twitter, which has, I think, gone up and down at times, is, you know, nobody wants to be the main character of the day. That's your job in life. If you participate in social media, don't do it. I know some people who have become the main character of the day. It's not very enjoyable to them ever. Occasionally, it's positive.
On either side. On any side, right?
Any part of it, right? Yeah. And so Twitter has built a machine that creates main characters of the day, sometimes multiple ones. And the issue is a right-wing accounts typically, but sources, accounts that want to encourage harassment up to the point of violence and real harm, they have figured out how to leverage the Twitter main figure of the day algorithmic feed so that they can cause harm by fluttering butterfly wings, right? So they can say something that isn't directly, doesn't meet any kind of First Amendment test, even of imminent harm, and doesn't meet Twitter's direct tests about incitement to violence or commitment of hatred of speech, but they are hate speech, but they surface up these accounts like libs of TikTok, surface up people who are absolutely innocuous and make them the 5 minute hate figure? What's it from 1984? Everybody in the world who is of that ilk gets that amplified out to them through the mechanism of Twitter and then other subsidiary mechanisms. And that person becomes a subject of this there's no reason it should happen. It's a failure of the network that happens.
I want to take a break. When we come back, he used AI to win a fine arts competition. Was it cheating? This is going to be a fun conversation. A great panel. You guys, I love this. This is going to be a long one, I can tell, because I don't ever want to stop when we have people like Dan Morin here from SixColors.com, Glenn Fleischman of Glenn.fun. I'm sorry. Glenn. I don't, my F key's broken, so I can only go to Glenn.un. Could you?
I'll register that to me.
Yeah, would you please?
I've been on Glenn.
I'll join the United Nations. So I can,
it's falling off. And somebody who lost her / and question mark key, but survived, Paris Martineau, reporter for
The
Information.
You know, I learned to ask fewer questions, and I think that's all right.
And go to fewer websites.
Yeah, all my websites are insecure now.
Yeah, right. No /. Our show today brought to you by Podium. If you own a small business, it's, you know, congratulations. You're still running. It's been a tough few years. From supply chain issues, increased demand, business owners have to manage. The businesses that are thriving right now are the ones who are forward-thinking, and that's why I love Podium. There are a number of businesses in our area that use Podium, and when I love it. I'll leave my dentist, and they as I'm leaving, I get a text message saying, hey, don't forget, your appointment is coming up in 6 weeks or whatever, and or maybe would you like to leave a review on Yelp or, that kind of thing. Podium helps your small business stay ahead of the curve with modern messaging tools that make it easy for your customers to connect with your business. And there's one thing we learned during the pandemic. No one wants to make a phone call. Texting is it. A lot of people hate calling a business. I don't care if it's a plumber, a landscaper. I hate playing phone tag. If I could just send a quick text message and get a text message back, I know that's the way to do it. Well, that's what Podium does. If you're running a business and the only way to get in touch with you is a phone number attached to an answering machine or a service, you're probably losing customers. Podium gives businesses the tools to compete with the convenience that, you know, big businesses have known about for a long time. From healthcare providers to plumbers, over 100,000 businesses are texting with customers through Podium. And by the way, not only do customers love it, you will love the results. One car dealer sold a truck in just 4 text messages. A jeweler sold a ring and coordinated curbside pickup, did it all through texts. And the customers love it. A dentist had a bunch of outstanding payments. He'd been sending him mail, you know, trying to get, he sent out payment requests through text, got 70% of the outstanding collections in just 2 weeks because it works. I don't remember, but the open rate, I think, on text is well over 90%. It's the number one way to reach people because it's effective. With Podium's all-in-one inbox, your employees will love it too. It all goes into the inbox, and you could do more than just chat. You can get online reviews by sending an easy-to-use link. You can collect payments, send marketing campaigns. I get, and I'm ashamed to say it really works, I get our local ice cream parlor. Every few weeks, I'll get something saying, hey, we haven't seen you in a while. How about 30% off a pint? And it works, gosh darn it, every single time. All by a quick text. Your employees can stay in touch with customers in one unified inbox. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today. You just go to podium.com/twit. podium.com/twit. If you want to know more, you can learn. The facts are there. And I think you probably, if you think about it, already know this is how your customers want to do business. Why don't you do it that way too? Podium.com/twit. Podium. Let's grow the ultimate text messaging platform. We thank them so much for supporting This Week in Tech. I loved this story, but it's actually kind of a deeper question. He won a fine arts competition, but was it cheating? This is Colorado State Fair digital category, the digitally manipulated photography category. Jason Allen won, beating 20 other artists. Blue ribbon, $300 prize, with an artwork he created through Midjourney, which is one of the new generative art tools that are just taking off. Somebody said it's a Cambrian explosion of AI art, and I think that may be accurate. The portrait, beautiful portrait. Looked like Renaissance art, although when I look at it, I can tell that's AI generated. I mean, that's clear to me, but maybe the judges didn't have as much experience with this stuff. Is it fair to? I mean, he says, "Well, I wrote the prompt," and then he imported it in Photoshop and fixed it up a little bit. So.
What category is it in? Was it in, like, painting?
No.
Normally they have a
digitally manipulated photography.
Okay, then that's fair.
Hard to argue with that.
I mean, that is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think if you're talking about high art or experimental art, using an AI to make a weird painting that kind of looks like a computer made it, that is art in and of itself.
If the judges don't know and they still look at it as just their work itself and are like, yeah, that's great. We love that. If they didn't know it was AI, I don't know. It's hard to, I find it hard to ding them on that. Even as someone who, you know, writes creatively, and I feel like if an AI wrote a book and that book won a competition,
ooh,
I would be probably a little miffed, but I also don't know that that would just probably make me a hypocrite. Then,
like, you got to hand it to it. Like, if somehow like, the AI made a better book,
it's a
good
book,
you're like,
right?
Well,
like, yeah.
I don't know.
I have a degree in art. Doesn't make me better informed on this, but I studied a lot of art history as part of that degree. And one of the courses looked at the concept of connoisseurship, which is how art is evaluated for its quality, right? So both by, like, you know, price, but also how do you evaluate pieces of art and say this is better or worse, or this is a masterwork and so forth. And I think that this actually gets into that, you know, very abstruse little thing like connoisseurship, is that there are, you know, this whole thing about kitsch, right? Kitsch was a concept developed by Clement Greenberg, like, I don't know, I think 80 years ago, to describe art that was pre-digested. You looked at it and it required no interpretation. He was talking about Soviet art and other art that was super pedagogical and designed to just be the kind of, you know, pabulum to the masses. You looked at it, it's like, this is the message, right? And that the opposite of kitsch is something that requires, you know, this interpretation. You look at it and there's a perception. And it was, you know, Jackson Pollock and all the people doing abstract impressionism, Dadaism before it, surrealism, and then pop art and later movements. They all rely on this impression that art is something beyond just looking at a thing and saying, that's a picture of a cake, right? So I'm sorry to get so deep into artistry stuff here, but it applies because you're like, on what basis do the judges evaluate this? Are the components that they evaluated as being winning work ones where they were mistaken things that they should have actually been looking at it more carefully? Or is it justified? Does this work actually, because of the sources in which it derives and how the algorithm has recombined it, does it make it justifiably something that you can compare and use that connoisseurship today? This is actually equivalent to other work of this caliber.
Or is it just prettier?
Is it prettier?
I will say, we do need to see what the other art works, competing work, because maybe they all really sucked. We're not considering that. Yeah. Two, if we're looking at this from an art history perspective, I think AI-generated art would be a very futurist, like, mm-hmm. piece. Like, this is kind of what the early futurist movement, like, around Impressionism was talking about, which is that, you know, art is not precious. Art can be fast. Art is, like, movement and technology. And if, in this case, art is typing in a couple words in a screen, that's art, baby.
I actually go beyond that. I think that the skill involved in typing the prompt, because it isn't usually just a few words, it's usually elaborate and you often refine it, is a form of computer programming. And I think maybe the future of computer programming, as we interact with machines, with AI, you know, computer programming up to this point, you very specific, the computer is going to do exactly what you said, no more, no less. But this is now the new way of communicating with a computer. It's more of a conversation. I think that that's actually the new form of programming. And I think we're going to see it in a lot of areas.
To me, I think the clearest indication that it, you know, is a valid form of art is that every new medium or style is always greeted with that question, but is it art?
Right.
You know,
look at the Impressionists. They were reviled, right? They had to have their own art show just to get show people their work.
If people are asking that question, I think the answer is usually yes. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not what you expect.
That's not art, whatever. It was just in the screen. Everything else.
The prompt for it is a still of Donald Trump and Alex Jones in jail, photograph, natural light, sharp detailed face, magazine press photo, Steve McCurry, oh, David Lazar, Canon, Nikon, Focus. These prompts, I mean, pick one you like.
Can we put a Leo-themed prompt in here?
Yeah. Is that... I did search for my name. This is the new Google search, I'm sorry to say.
Was that your first search?
Yeah, one of my first. So this is
Leonard Cohen in the upper left corner there.
Yeah. Well, this is a search engine that searches Stable Diffusion. Stable Diffusion is responsible for a lot of this Cambrian explosion over the last 2 weeks. It's an open source generator that's been made available to anybody. You can install it if you have enough horsepower, big enough GPU, and run it yourself. There are a lot of nuances to this story, a lot of facets to this story. One of the problems with Stable Diffusion, according to some, is it uses a lot of images, we'll talk about this later, that are not in the public domain as its training material. And yet, because people can play with it, we've seen a lot of progress in the stuff we can generate. How about, I'll just do Adam Driver. How about that? Because they're more of him.
A clear one-to-one for you.
Yeah, me and Adam Driver. So these are all images that include that. Now, one thing Stable Diffusion does is it will show.
There's some Nazi iconography.
Yeah, I was going to say there's some.
Good. Excellent.
This one is a portrait of John Oliver standing next to Adam Driver's stoic, full-body military uniform.
That's weird.
Fantasy, intricate, elegant. Like
John Oliver did an excellent segment, by the way, recently on marrying a cabbage.
He did. And he married a cabbage.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. In fact, if I search for John Oliver, I'll find a lot more of his material. And it looks
it's really just Adam Driver.
Adam Driver.
It's all Adam Driver.
That's why
I never thought about that, but
well,
yes.
John and Adam have a history, I guess. But
they do. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of John Adam.
Oh, that's right. They have that.
Oh, there's a lot of him, John Oliver, covered in blood in a way that I would not have expected.
Well,
that came from, he did a lot of searches, I think, in preparation. Well, he was searching on people doing searches of him or work about him.
Yeah.
And then found the one in which he buried a cabbage.
Highly recommend watching that segment that from the last Sunday's.
Oh, God. That one over the right is terrifying.
This one?
Yes. That is my actual nightmare.
This is a facial portrait of John Oliver looking at the camera, laughing like a maniac, colorful background, lighting like in the Blair Witch Project.
His teeth look like corn.
They don't mention
like
corn
Joker
teeth.
Joker and John Oliver had a baby.
Yeah. So
hey, Dan,
I find
remember,
this
there's
stuff.
A classic. There's a classic sci-fi story. I want to say it's by C.M. Kornbluth, but I may be wrong. In which a machine falls through from the future into like 1940s or 50s, and a guy finds it and he discovers it produces art. He gives it limited inputs and it produces beautiful work. And what he doesn't realize is it's written in a language he doesn't understand. And so he sends off, it looks like Swedish, so he sends off an instruction manual that came with it to get it translated. As he's using it, he starts to make these contracts. He's getting gallery shows. It's all being produced by the machine. And what he finds out, he gets the translation back, and it's a form. The person's like, this looks a little like Swedish, but he's been pressing the delete button all the time. So as the last image comes out, it's basically empty, and it draws a circle. And I was like, it was a perfect... It's a perfect story from 80 years ago or 70 years ago about this idea of like automated art from the future. But then you hit the wrong button and you're done. It's all over.
One senior research scientist at Google actually is sounding an alarm. Nagar Rostamzadeh says, can't believe Stable Diffusion is out there for public use, and that's considered okay.
Wait, why?
Google's been very careful, as has OpenAI, to limit access to some of these engines. And apparently, some scientists think you've released the Kraken. if you've released AI. I think what is required for the development of a lot of these things is kind of this tight loop of interaction. And I think Stable Diffusion, that's exactly what's happened. It's getting better and better, and it's more and more intriguing. I just typed in bunny, and I'm getting a lot of weird things.
I was about to say, that's a not safe for work search.
Well, apparently, portrait of Taylor Swift as Lola Bunny in Space Jam.
Wow. Again, another sentence that I would not have expected to end like
extra
that.
Extra arms.
There's a lot more.
A third arm.
There's a third arm. Yeah.
You need a third arm.
I
mean, this is, we're talking about day one earlier. You know, I've ridiculed Bezos using that because, you know, they're not a startup anymore. They want to pretend to be one, and they're a multi-billion-dollar company.
It's day two or day three at Amazon.
Here's Joe Biden wearing bunny ears.
We are day one for a lot of AI stuff. It's amazing how much utility we can get out of AI, and it's still not very good by many measures. Like, you know, if you can... I think voice recognition has gotten pretty good, but it still has a long way to go. This is in the early days of being practical, and it produces remarkable stuff. The Midjourney stuff can be incredible. Chuck Wendig, horror author. Dan, what do you call Chuck Wendig?
Weird
multi-genre.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Enigma.
Guy. Great. And very funny guy. And I think, interesting user of technology, and he is constantly publishing, instead of writing probably, his Midjourney queries onto Instagram. You're like, it's so beautiful sometimes, it's hard for me to believe this could be any kind of amalgamation, that it's not directly from a source.
Here's some...
not that image, though.
This is from the Midjourney Community Showcase. So these are... And this is another thing. My mom always said, if all good bakers leave many cakes on the windowsill, if you're going to... You throw out the bad ones, but if you're going to show in a community showcase, it's a success. And I would say these are stunning, these images.
The first, 15 you scrolled through all looked like PlayStation 5, title characters, basically.
Yeah. Well, I maybe those prompts. But, I mean, look at this. This looks like breathtaking Baroque beauty, blonde beauty, full head, oval,
it's
Baroque frame.
Not Baroque.
Right. But you know what? It's something. Here's a crescent moon covered in vines and roses. Art Nouveau.
I mean, if it can't get, if it ain't Baroque, don't fix it.
Right? Or something like that. I knew you were going to go there.
I just had to.
I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you follow communities of cartoonists and illustrators, they're more freaked out than authors are. Maybe we're past being freaked out by it. I don't know about automation.
Yeah, I don't know. There's always something very tempting in this to me too, as somebody who has very little like visual art skills whatsoever. And has done some work with, like, you know, stock photos, making some book covers for stuff I'd self-published. I mean, the idea that you could generate art that would be not just a stock photo that you've sort of manipulated or worked with, like, I don't know, it's an attractive option, because there's no way in a million years that I would get the skills and develop them and have time to, like, sort of spend all the time it would require to get to this point. Does it mean it's taking jobs away from, like, people I could be paying to do that? I don't know. That's an interesting question.
I
think where it gets complicated is I've seen a lot of major media publications as of late come under fire for using, like, lead images and stories that are generated by Midjourney or DALL-E or something like that, when... It's like, this is the sort of illustration that typically these publications are paying a couple dozen different freelance artists any given week or month to create. I think The Atlantic's Charlie Warzel had recently gotten some hot water because he has a small budget for his newsletter, so he's already just using stock images
rather than illustrations.
Had used the most horrifying photo of Alex Jones at a newsstand generated, I think, by Midjourney, and it was... I mean, people were quite upset about it.
Were they upset because of the image, or upset because it took the took bread out of the mouth of some illustrator somewhere?
I mean, I think that people seeing it without context saw it and they were like, oh, The Atlantic, a publication that has a lot of money and typically is going to be paying and working with illustrators, is using an artificial intelligence powered system to create their lead artists. Like, if The Atlantic is doing it, what is stopping any other publication? I mean, I think this is a little bit of a different case because he had a follow-up newsletter where he explained, I just run my small newsletter and have a very limited budget. But I do think that it begs some question when you're talking about larger publications.
Does it devalue the work too, right? Because if you are a freelance illustrator and you're like, well, here's my rate, and they're like, well, we could just go to an AI and plug in a few words and get the
by the way
same thing
this is generated by Midjourney, and the caption says it's by Midjourney. Alex Jones inside an American office under fluorescent lights, and but also I should point out Midjourney retains the right to these images. If they're turned into an NFT, it may get a cut.
Yeah, NFT is the most popular thing. I, as a musician, I know, told me the most horrifying phrase I've ever heard about creativity a few years ago. She said, I'm competing against all music ever published now. And I think that might be what terrifies artists, and rightly so. As a writer, I'm slightly terrified because I don't... It's funny, it's not like it's easier to do art, but it's harder to get a corpus to produce, say, a news article or analysis of a contemporary thing, or even a description of something, because you have to have a deep corpus. But with art, the corpus is all art ever created. And so every time a rabbit appears in anything, that could be fodder for an AI to use. So it's really the sheer amount, right? It's the training set. So I don't think someone's going to write an article about, I don't think an AI could write a feasibly credible article now or in the next few years about a person entering an AI-generated piece of art into a contest and winning.
I don't know, and I've seen some. There were those ones. I can't remember what the library was, but what was there was a thing recently where it would generate a story in the same sort of way. You could write a story in this way. I know because our pal Lex Friedman did it. Like, write a description of this podcast, and it was. Surprisingly good. Again, I think the biggest
full length. Could you write a feature that way?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, right? I mean, not now, maybe, but I wouldn't discount it for the future. And I think the biggest challenge with this is this argument. argument ultimately moot, because it's like, well, the genie's out of the bottle. Like, once it's out there, you can't stop it. It's done. So
yeah, it comes down to rights. It's like the source material, the training set to me becomes the issue. We were talking about that on this very podcast with Christina Warren, who couldn't talk about it because she works for Microsoft, and the Copilot product some weeks ago, because that's the same thing. It's like if they're a public, yeah. You know, this art isn't even public, right? Some of it is art that's copyrighted, but it was.
So Andy Bio did a very interesting study. He, this is waxy.org. He stabled a few, unlike DALL-E 2, OpenAI does not release the training set. So we can't see where that came from. Because Stable Diffusion is open source, you know where it came from, where the training set came from. He says, we indexed the 12 million images in a sample. By the way, there are many, many more images. They didn't want to go through 2.3 billion images. So they took a subset, 12 million images, and they indexed them. By domain, half the images were sourced from only 100 domains, and the largest number of images came from Pinterest.
Mm.
8.5% of the total data set scraped from Pinterest. So completely disregarding copyright or ownership. Fine Art America, second biggest domain, which sells art prints and posters. 244,000 from Shopify, then Wix and Squarespace, Redbubble. So it's scraped images all over the net. Number one artist of the top 25 artists in the data set, only three are still living: Phil Koch, Aaron Hansen, and Steve Henderson. The most frequent artist, who would you guess? Thomas Kincaid.
Of course.
The painter of light trademark.
Well, and it depends to a certain degree, like, how does this, I don't know enough about the technology of this one to know how that works in terms of ingesting that material. I mean, one argues that if you are an artist, you have gone and looked at a lot of art, and you have that art as a
You've done the same thing.
Yeah.
Good point.
As long as you're not storing those, if you're just sort of exposing the AI to that and it's deriving its own conclusions, I don't know. That seems legit to me, but maybe I'm not taking everything into consideration here.
Yeah.
It's the same thing we're talking about Copilot. Same thing with JavaScript.
Yeah.
This is why we should legally ban every artist who has a photographic memory from looking at any art.
Right. You know, this is a story of Harrison Bergeron, right? The Kurt Vonnegut story about someone who is, the society in which everyone has to be equal, but they define equal by disabling people who are too good instead of raising up everybody to the same level. And so Harrison Bergeron is the most beautiful, capable, intelligent, agile person. And so he has to walk around wearing like 300 pounds of weights and disfiguring masks and so forth. And it does get you to those fields where you're like, well, the AI should be blind. It must be blinded because it can see too much beauty.
For some reason, when you described that, I thought, someone would make a good point and you just club them in the knee, disable them immediately. Like, just chop off an arm. You were too smart in that meeting. Sorry. Gotta take down a peg.
Andy did an interesting thing. He gave a prompt, the same prompt to DALL-E 2 and Stable Diffusion. On the left, realistic 3D rendering of Mickey Mouse working on a vintage computer doing his taxes. And you can see that the one on the left, the DALL-E 2 image, doesn't know who Mickey Mouse is. It's just a mouse.
That's the original Mickey Mouse.
That's what it used to look like.
White tank top, yeah.
Yeah, wife beater.
That's what he had on before. When he goes off for the day, and he goes to relax. Maybe that's what he
Mickey
looks.
Mouse after hours. But but in Stable Diffusion, it knows who Mickey Mouse is because it's trained on Mickey Mouse. And so
that alone is going to get them into trouble, right?
Because
Disney comes saying, hey, you got to pay up for that. That's our property.
Yeah. It's so that does raise an issue. Then there's also the issue of AI generated pornography. And a number of publications have started to point out there may be more of this appearing. Stable Diffusion team built a predictor for adult material, assigned every image this must have been a fun project, an NSFW probability score ranging from 0 to 1. So about 2.9% of the English language images were unsafe, but it's so there's definitely hardcore content.
Leo, we've wrapped around back to that first story. Here's the solution to all that age verification. Everything on the internet is produced by AI. It's tagged as to how unsafe it is. And then you can all the content. There you go.
Nice.
There we go.
Perfect.
Solved.
The internet doesn't have any idea about Mickey Mouse, and I think that's beautiful.
I think the future is a fax machine which feeds into a shredder. That's my future.
Oh, that's
so it's
great.
AIs consuming content generated by AIs. We don't need to be involved.
Yeah, we just take a break, go to the beach, relax.
Right, let them do their work.
Good research from Andy Bio, and I'm not sure what it concludes. I there's a lot of copyright violation. And there's certainly a lot of cribbing from existing art. I still think, though, that it's interesting because we've seen it's been such a stop and start thing. AI. There's been several AI winters already. We've seen how difficult it is to get cars to drive safely, to get voice assistants to answer intelligently. And yet, I think in this one area, AI has made a huge amount of progress very quickly. Or is that just my imagination?
We fill in details visually better, right? We see things that aren't there. And, if 10 words in a row are misspelled, we're going to notice that. Or if the sentence doesn't make sense,
good
it has
point.
To make logical sense. But we look at, the Mickey Mouse one on the right there. It's, Mickey's hand has two fingers and it's distorted and the keyboard doesn't have all the keys. And that's okay. We don't notice that as much.
You're
right?
He's doing his taxes. Kinda, I get it.
He's doing his taxes. Yeah.
The Mickey on the left is using a external clickety-clack keyboard on what looks like a typewriter.
There's paper.
Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, we're like, the mouse is ripped and doing his taxes.
And I think that's actually, Paris, your keyboard, because it looks like it's missing the question mark.
That's true, serious mouse.
I'd like to know if the rear end next to you is AI generated that appeared during the break. That's my question.
Could be. Could be. I don't know.
Suddenly, I noticed. All right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the sequined, I understand. That's that piece of art.
This is the sequined mannequin butt. Yes.
I understand that.
I can't figure out which way to turn. Yes. brought it in.
Wow.
No,
that's straight out of Stable Diffusion.
Listen,
wow.
What's the
NSFW prompt
on
now.
Yeah.
Printing plus AI plus 3D printing, you'll type in sequin mannequin butt, and then it'll come out of your device, and you'll have, there you go.
And you'll be like, mannequin butt only has one butt cheek, but I get it.
Do you remember when there was the fear over nanotechnology of gray goo, everything would turn to gray goo? Now I'm worried that we're going to be awash in 3D printed stuff generated by AI. It's this little plastic everywhere that an AI has created.
Oh my God. I think that's likely
around.
Now.
It's like a mouse with six arms.
Take on a lot of robotics and AI stuff, and I don't know if this is, I sometimes feel like I'm way off base, and sometimes I feel like I'm seeing it as a trend, is augmentation, right? We have more people, despite the pandemic, more people are now employed in America than there were before the pandemic. We've recovered from that. Employment continues ever upward, even as American productivity, just to take us as an easy to find example, productivity continues on an unprecedented pace continuously for all American workers, blah, 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 right? We have so much robotics now. We have AIs engaged in a lot of aspects of daily life. I think you use this, Paris, you may as well, AI-based transcription for interviews and things like that, at least as a first pass, if not the verbatim one.
I love Trent.
You love
it
who?
I'm using
Trent.
Trent, he's a great fellow that just listens to all of my interviews and kind of mashes some buttons. It's really helpful.
Oh, Trent with an I, yes.
Trent with an I. It's a really good transcription.
Yes. It's not a guy named
Otter.
Trent.
I thought you loved Trent. I didn't know.
Listen, Trent.
Otter.ai. Otter is integrated with
Otter's another one.
Integrated with Zoom, and it made a huge difference in my reporting. It would sometimes take hours out of the work I was doing to have a searchable thing. So this was substantial augmentation. My word rate or my hourly rate for articles I wrote essentially went up by paying a relatively low yearly fee to have this AI assistance. So augmentation, my question is, and I think a lot of artists are thinking about this now, people like web cartoonists and folks who do commercial art, the field has shrunk and it's a very complicated one already. So the question is, does this become an augmentation where they can use this as a tool, as a visualization tool? Is it something that helps them get to where they're going faster for commercial work? Or, as a writer, do I wind up, there's another science fiction story in which, some writers like us are sitting there typing moving away and you have to control the AI from moving too fast ahead of you, but it's a partnership and it allows someone to produce more work that's more accurate and more quickly, maybe less creative, or you're providing the creative component. So there is a future in which augmentation reduces less of the scut work and produces a better impact. But again, you know, we have so many professions and fields have been roboticized or have had even tiny robots or other kinds of automation added in the last 50 years, and yet employment, right? We're not employing 50% fewer people. We're at all-time high employment in American history.
Yeah, in fact, there's too many jobs for too few people.
More so, robot hamburger flippers, right?
Apparently. I think you nailed it, though. I mean, honestly, the best self-driving cars are not driving entirely on their own. They're not level 4 or 5. It's level 2, where it's human augmentation. And that's why it's a mistake to call it autopilot. But that those kinds of, you know, self-driving vehicles are great. They're not self-driving. They're assist. They're computer assist. And I think that works well. By the way, Trent, have you tried Otter? Which is better, Paris? You like Trent?
I have been a Trent fan for many years. I find that Otter, for me, I don't know. I know a lot of people who swear by Otter. I found that it doesn't often transcribe with the same level of accuracy. And most importantly for me, I think that Trent's, that's T-R-I-N-T, not my friend Trent. Trent's editing service is really perfect for the sort of things that I use transcription for. Yeah. Like once you load up your transcription, you kind of have a time coded, like live transcription of it that scrolls with the audio. And you can, whenever, let's say if there's a word that it got wrong, you go in to edit it and it pauses. And then once you're done editing, it restarts at the word right after. So I think it's like really good for the sort of workflow that I do, but I know a lot of people enjoy Otter.
I should point out there's another reason I discovered Otter was for live captioning. And I should point out this is an incredible area in which it was almost impossible to get and now is widely available, is you needed live people typing to do real-time transcription of conversations. Now, there are a billion conversations a day that can be transcribed or can have live captions.
Google Skype does built an it amazing in. Job with Android 12 and 13.
And Skype right. is incredible. Apple's yeah. adding it in iOS 6. Yeah, Apple's. So, and that is a, I mean, so 99.999% of all phone conversations, video conferences, and whatever did not have live captions. And now you have the potential, and I suspect it is a more than 10% number where people enable that. And that is, oh my God, the amount of cognitive energy that saves and the improvement in conversation. So not like I want to be AI only has positive impacts, but I'm like, my wife has hearing issues. She can't drive at night. Like I look at AI and improvements in all these kinds of automations and robotics as tools for people, you know, directly near me where it's going to improve, captions already improve her life, and augmentation that would allow like night vision or other tools. It'll have to be full automated driving could allow her to drive at night again safely.
Yeah. DALL-E 2 has announced a new feature called Outpainting, which is kind of another way of taking a human generated product and then applying. So I'll show you the time lapse of Vermeer's The Girl with the Pearl Earring. DALL-E 2 is painting the room the girl's in. Oh, and it's not obviously probably not the real room, but it's pretty credible.
Oh, it's weird.
It's so weird.
Did you see the example of someone? She was she's a fashion designer and technologist, and she created a video by combining outpainting and like two or three other tools to create seamless images. And it just shows her like walking down the street, and her outfit is changing into AI generated alternatives as she walks. And it's
I did see that video. It's phenomenal.
Great. I can't remember. Yeah, and it's, she's cobbled together a bunch of stuff.
That Vermeer thing, though, I mean, it really makes the girl with the pearl earring look like a bit of a slob.
She's not very tidy.
What is going on there?
Yeah.
Like, do you need that many lemons on your shelf? Like, put them in the fridge.
I don't know. Yeah.
The girl with the clutter problem.
Maybe AI has a problem. Maybe AI is a hoarder.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Weird.
How many lemons That's do you weird. Need? AI?
Lots of teacups up on that top shelf there. What is happening? With some perspective issues too, with where those shelves are angled.
So now I'm realizing.
It's like, man, have you got so many Amazon packages there in the bottom right? She's got to really take the recycling out.
Now I'm realizing that you were right, Glenn Fleischman, that we are filling in the details that make it feel better than it really is if you look closely.
This is Vermeer by way of M.C. Escher.
Yeah, it's kind of awful.
It's kind of cool, though.
Yeah, it's kind of like cool, kind of awful. That's basically
this looks
the...
kind of iSpy.
And what's this thing hanging here? What is this? Is that a...
We're just that's a light pole, right? It's a light... Oh,
that's a boom mic.
It looks like a mouse hanging by its tail.
Yeah, I don't. Vermeer edited out. It was a goof, and that's why Vermeer...
Yeah. It's actually under the goof section of IMDb. You know,
that's right. Exactly.
See it in the frame.
What if AI is
this,
like?
If Vermeer had painted this, would we say, "Oh, what a beautiful painting! This is art." I don't know. That is fascinating to me. Oh my
God. I don't know. I feel like it was long enough ago. Like, this is kind of impressive because it just like, man, you survived. You didn't get enough. You didn't die of illness in the time it took you to paint this. Yeah.
This took 16 years to paint. I hope you got a good price.
Yeah.
For it.
Yeah.
It's
man, that's great.
Do you think AI might be slightly psychotic? Like,
it's not conscious, so who knows?
I hesitate to give a clinical diagnosis to a piece of.
Yeah, I don't know. We're not armchair. We don't want an armchair psychologist AI
enough.
Here.
I'll call Georgia Dow and see if she'll.
Here's an interesting application.
Oh, AI therapy. That's going to be a growth industry.
AI.
I think we started with that, Glenn. That was where Eliza came from.
Yeah, was literally Eliza. We're full circle.
Oh, my. No, but therapist for the AI, not therapist for us.
The AI needs
Yeah,
analysis.
The AI is going to be scrolling through TikTok, and it's going to tell the AI you have ADHD and have got to get stimulants right now.
Georgia Dow, therapist to AIs. That's going to be our new podcast.
Here is, I think, a very good use of AI. Storybooks.ai. They want to take all of the Gutenberg Project public domain text and illustrate it with AI.
It's a fascinating idea.
Is that an interesting idea?
It's problematic in an entirely different way. Although what's weird is the original drawings of many of these works exist. Like many of these works were illustrated and they're not in copyright either. So, but it's an interesting exploration.
Is that what Sherlock Holmes looks like?
No, I don't like it.
I don't like it. I don't like it one
bit.
What
is going on with his jaw?
Oh, yeah.
You've become AI critics, you guys. Let's see.
Listen, you know.
They are going to need therapy after.
If they're producing art, they better be okay with getting
Philip
criticized.
Philip K. Dick's, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? That would be a natural for AI, right?
A very thick man.
Rick Deckard, Rose Galactic, from the Bed.
What is it called? Galactic... Pot Sherd Healer or something. It's one of his strangest works. Much better, though.
Philip K. Dick?
I do think we have to try and analyze why AI is obsessed with making ripped arms, you know? Like, every arm is jacked.
Because it's been trained on Jeff Bezos images. That's why.
That's true.
But then the next one will be very long.
It has no arms, and it must pump iron.
A little too much.
You'll want to know a fun fact I've never been able to get in copy, but I've heard from sources. Since Jeff Bezos got on his fitness kick, you know, obviously to kind of go to space, he started taking, he never would use the elevators at Amazon's HQ when he was CEO. He would always take the stairs up and down. And that meant, of course, due to the power, like politics, like internal politics dynamics of working amongst, like next to a CEO who's trying to get jacked, all of his underlings would also be like, oh, I got to take the stairs. Jeff is up there. I can't be seen in the elevator. And I think that's just very funny sometimes.
You worked at Amazon, didn't you, Glenn? You know that? Do you know the story?
Yeah, I think I don't know if you did it at the time. I worked in Amazon when we were on the second and fourth floor of the Columbia. But yeah, I think he walked to the fourth floor. I think his office is on the second floor.
He had
a rack of identical shirts behind him, though. That's all I remember.
Wall Street Journal article this weekend: Yachts and Watches. The real CEO flex is washboard abs.
Amazing.
Elon
Musk.
There's the counterexample. Elon Musk getting hosed down by Ari Emanuel.
I've never felt better about Elon Musk and seeing that. It makes me feel very sympathetic to him.
Listen, we all want to believe in our hearts that we would be the Jeff Bezos physique if we were billionaires, but really a lot of us would be the Elon Musk physique.
If you had the money. Here's from Selling Sunset, the Jason Oppenheim, the the buff realtor.
Jeff Bezos.
Here's Jeff Bezos pulling a Putin.
On a horse.
I was going to say, it was very Vladimir Putin looking.
Yeah. Here is the video gaming
executive.
Oh, no,
that is too tight.
Stress. Oh. Zelnick.
AI can, that out for me.
You can see Nip. That's too tight.
It's the Batman costume. It's the tiny outfit.
I think the best part of that says photo courtesy of Strauss. All these layers, like, oh, you give us your best picture.
The Wall Street Journal reached out and was like, "Hey, can we get a photo? We're doing this one about Lockport abs."
You got anything where he shows nips?
I need to see your 8-pack, sir.
Mr. Zelnick, who favors twice daily workouts and says he exercises up to 12 times a week, is not dad-botting it, and neither are friends like Mr. Emanuel, chief executive of media company Endeavor, the journal says.
Oh, my God.
On a recent visit to Mr. Emanuel's office in Beverly Hills, Mr. Zelnick said the executive took phone calls and wrote emails while walking at a treadmill desk. Mr. Emanuel, who did not walk during his actual meeting with Zelnick, did not comment.
Oh, treadmill desk, nothing. You need to have, like, a rowing machine desk.
Yeah.
All right. I have to say, I'm a little closer
desk.
On the Elon to Ari scale. I'm a little closer to the Elon side of that scale. But that's the new thing. If you got the money, washboard abs.
It's always they're cheap. You can order them on Amazon. Slap them right on.
That's true, yeah.
It costs a lot of money to look as good as people who have to do manual labor.
I think probably, Paris, you're glad you didn't get assigned this story.
Yeah,
that's an Amazon story you didn't really want to write.
Not really. Don't need to spend any more time looking at the physiques of tech executives. No. I think it's a little weird.
Hey, let's take a little break. Fun panel today. Paris Martineau from The Information. Glenn Fleischman from Glenn F. Glenn.fun. I'm sorry. He's Glenn F. on Twitter.
You're going to get it by the fourth ad break.
If I could just get this F key working here.
What the F?
Why the F key? Like, was I pounding hard on?
Leo, you're
working
got
hard
10
on
more
ligatures.
F keys at the top there.
What?
You got 10 more F keys right at the top.
Oh,
F1 thing.
Just apply.
Yeah, sign an F key to the F key.
What happened here? My computer just
macro time
just died. That is, of course, Dan Morin, the author of the Galactic Cold War saga. If we're all really nice to him, maybe he will write another one soon.
The Cambrian explosion was not one of your books, as I recall. That was
no, not yet.
Caledonian Gambit.
Caledonian Gambit is not the Cambrian explosion.
Yeah.
Our show today brought to you by ClickUp. Imagine in your 5-day work week having one of those days off, right? One extra day a week. What would you do with the time? I'd be watching more reality TV. Maybe you'd cook healthy meals. Maybe you'd work out more, get that buff CEO bod, or maybe like Dan, you'd write volume 4 of the Galactic Cold War, an extra day a week. Well, you can with ClickUp, the productivity platform. That's so good, it'll save you a day a week on work guaranteed. ClickUp began with the premise that productivity was broken. There were too many tools to keep track of, too many things, and you siloed into completely separate ecosystems. There had to be a better way, a more productive way to get through the daily hustle. ClickUp does it. One tool to house all the tools you use, all your tasks, projects, all your docs and goals and spreadsheets and more. And it's a great idea for any size team, even if it's a team of one, if it's just you, or for a 1,000-plus people packed with features and customization options no other productivity tool has. Out of the box, you'll be productive immediately, but you can also customize it to work the way you work best, whether you're in project management or engineering or sales or marketing or HR. Everybody gets an easy-to-use solution that creates a more efficient work environment. It's ClickUp. Join more than 800,000 highly productive teams using ClickUp today. Our offer code, TWIT, will get you 15% off ClickUp's massive unlimited plan for a year. That means you can start reclaiming your time for under $5 a month. Sign up today at ClickUp.com. Use the code TWIT. But don't delay. This offer doesn't last forever. It's limited time. Thank you, ClickUp, for supporting Twit.
clickup.com. And again, the offer code is TWIT. Thank you, ClickUp. Well, Wednesday's a big day. Apple is... I think there should be a new word for the Apple events. It's a product launch, but it's also an infomercial. Could we call it a launch-a-mercial? I don't know.
Is any product launch not an infomercial, Leo?
No. Well, actually, all of these are, aren't they? In fact, I'm kind of thinking, should we really be giving these the coverage that we do? But people want to know. People want to see it.
Could call them eye candy.
Yes.
Oh, boo.
I get it.
I think we should call them should be in an email.
Maybe. You know, that's a reporter talking. Can you just send me the talking points, please?
Right. I will say, one of the happiest moments of my life is when I changed in the tech reporter world from having to sit at like 2-3 different computers paying attention during all the Apple releases to not caring about it. Yeah. And just witnessing it as a consumer.
Did you ever have to do that, Dan? Sit at the computer and transcribe the...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep. I live blogged a bunch of events, financial calls, which are always the best because everybody loves.
Oh yeah, now I'm here on quarterly earnings.
Yep, done that a lot.
This is Tim.
From one fire to another.
This is Tim.
Yeah. This is Tim. Good morning.
Good morning.
Will you be going, Dan, to the Apple campus this week?
No, with a 6-week old, I will not be going to the Apple campus.
Jason will.
Doesn't seem like the Apple execs will be going either, right? Yep. Last time they were just there via video, right?
I was there in June, which was an interesting experience. And I know Jason will be there, and Leo, your pal and mine, Micah Sargent, I believe, will be there as well.
Yep.
So that's very exciting.
Leaving me in the lurch all alone, sitting here snarking during the infomercial. But that's all right. That's the job I chose. It's interesting because the invite said Steve Jobs Theater. So the event you went to in June was outside with a big screen.
Well, yeah, you could sit outside, or it was partially in the
cafe
ring, right? Yeah, the Cafe Max in the ring. Yeah, so we were just indoors for that, but it was like open air. But the Steve Jobs Theater definitely suggests a more traditional presentation than what we saw in June.
And yet,
calling it the rings makes it sound like Tim Cook is going to fight someone.
It's like the octagon. Tim Cook versus Jeff
Tim
Bezos.
Cook. He's got some washboard abs.
Now, we've never seen Tim's nipples, but I have a feeling he probably does have a six-pack under there.
Every story about Tim
this
is
reminds
about
me.
Was working out.
This does remind me of the time I got a call from a reporter asking about Jeff Bezos' private parts, and I'm glad that story never ran.
Oh, I remember that. Was it National Enquirer?
Thank you, Mr. Pecker.
Mr. Pecker. Jesus. Aptly named the head of the National Enquirer.
I did do that interview, and then I was like, maybe I don't need to be talking about Jeff Bezos' private parts. Not from personal knowledge.
You know what? Jeff called their bluff. He said, go ahead.
That was one of the best PR moves I have seen in a long time. Like, is... taking what should have been a moment of weakness and somehow spinning it into, no, I'm going to drop all the receipts and then also make a couple of, like, puns.
This was, of course, going back to when the National Enquirer claimed, and I think they got it from his girlfriend's brother, which was really shameful.
Well,
text messages.
Is it proven?
Huh?
I don't know. I wasn't sure if it was proven. I think it was pretty strongly. The correlation.
I believe there was litigation. I'm not sure as to how that shook out, though.
Very icky, very squirmy.
Yeah, the whole thing.
But that's called, what do they call that in PR, where you take the lead on a story? You get ahead of the story. He got way ahead of the story.
Way ahead of that
story. He got so far ahead of the story that it was like, well, we can't publish these now. They'll just, just ruin it.
Instead of like leaning into a crash, he caused like a different crash.
Yeah. Yeah,
but it somehow ended up okay.
Good for him. He's, I guess, doing all right. Anyway, back to Apple.
Doing all right.
This is what
Jeff
I do.
Bezos
he's
story.
Doing all right. Yeah.
He's okay.
Whatever happened to him?
Is he happy?
Do you think he's really back happy? Together. What a rough time he's had.
He's just going to space whenever he feels going like it. Wearing a cowboy hat. Driving some helicopters. You know, doing okay.
Billionaires in space. That's a story from a few months
ago. Capitalist pigs in space, I think you meant.
More like.
somebody in the chat room says,
I don't know, you just said the same thing. Yeah.
Doing all right, the Jeff Bezos story. I think you're right. That could be the name. Apple's Pro products will steal the show at the iPhone 14 launch event, says Mark Gurman. One of the things I'm a little interested in, the rumor that the new Apple Watch Pro, kind of bigger, heftier sport model, will cost as much as $900.
It's still not the most expensive Apple Watch ever made by a long shot.
Yes.
Right? Yes. I mean, this is, they've slowly come down.
Short of that.
Yeah, they've come down over the years. So $900 is a price point I feel like is a pretty reasonable ask. Plus, I mean, you know, Apple always tried to position those watches as a fashion accessory. If you know anybody who's like really into watches, you spend way more than $900.
Yeah, really. But that was Johnny's folly, the Apple Watch solid gold.
I won't disagree with that.
I feel like with Johnny gone, it's a little tone deaf to say we're going to make a $900 Apple Watch.
Well, the question is, what is this? What is the story Apple's going to tell about why is this watch better than the watches we already have? What makes this a pro watch? Is it just that it's bigger? Is there something else going on here? You know, I think,
what could they do to make it worth that much?
That's a great question.
They'll tell you exactly the time that you'll
tell you. How much time you have left. Right.
It's a theme.
It's just a countdown clock.
Counting down. Why is this watch going backwards? This seems ominous.
Yeah. Gurman does remind us that, you know, you can get a solar powered Garmin watch for, and that's $1,300. So it's not unheard of. In these high-end sport watches to spend a significant amount of money.
I think Mark made the point as well that it's just some of this is Apple's way of saying we don't want to cede that portion of the market. We are, right. We are a premium product brand, so therefore if we can be charging people more and they will pay it, then we should be doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Apple holds 36% of the smartwatch market. I would have thought it would be a bigger percentage. That's according to Counterpoint Research.
Yeah, that's actually surprising.
Yeah. Garmin is the market share leader for watches over $100. So Garmin is, I think you're right, got a target on its back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My thought is, I mean, obviously this is incredibly speculative, but I feel like there's always been people talking about how Apple could at one point buy Peloton. And I think that would be the thing that would really jumpstart their watch business if they kind of sold it as a tie-in to some sort of exercise-based platform in a way that kind of broadened all the aspects of their fitness ecosystem as well as Apple Music. It could, I think, really kind of bring about an interesting flywheel effect. Probably they won't do it because Peloton's a big flaming trash fire, but...
Well, it makes it cheaper, right?
And that's true.
Fitness Plus is already doing a lot of that for them. I mean, they already have watch integration with that, and it is placed...
And with, I believe, Life Fitness.
Music and all that stuff, too. Yeah, so I don't know what Peloton would get them other than just scooping up
hardware,
a lot of talent.
Yeah,
and I don't think they want...
Apple could just buy all the Peloton...
bikes.
Yeah.
Apple could just buy all the Pelotons used. They're so cheap now. Just buy a bunch of Pelotons.
Peloton has announced that they're going to start selling their bikes in Amazon, and they're going to stop doing the white glove install service. Right. I think Peloton's angling to get bought by Amazon, to be honest with you.
Okay, my thought, though, is once they start selling these bikes on Amazon, they're going to have a nightmare on their hands because... The delivery of Peloton bikes is very complicated.
Yes.
The bikes are very fragile. I know this because I have one.
I do too. And
somehow, when it was
hell.
Delivered, broke immediately. And it was just that one wire was slightly pulled the wrong way. And it literally took like multiple different technicians coming out. They had to replace each piece of the bike fully from the ground up. Then another person moved it once when they were replacing one other part of it, and they had to do it all over again. I mean, if you have an average Amazon delivery person somehow now trucking in your Peloton bike, it's going to blow apart. It's going to turn to dust.
How many hundreds of pounds does it weigh? Also, am I exaggerating? It's heavy.
It's not hundreds, but it might be 100. I mean,
it might be 100.
That flywheel has to have a lot of weight. That's what you're moving when you pedal. So it has to be heavy.
That's a hard box to get into a lot of places without some.
I agree. You couldn't get it up three
flights.
Nobody
really makes light exercise equipment. I always say this to somebody who helps people move weights a lot. Like, these are just designed to be heavy. That is all they do.
You know, wait a minute. That's a hot category. Light exercise equipment. I like it. If this were Shark Tank, I'd give you some money.
There's some exercise stuff you can fill with water later, and then it gets heavy.
Oh, that's not good. That's silly. That's like lifting milk jugs.
Water's. Wait, what's wrong with water? What are you,
Rocky?
I don't know.
I've
heard that every person who's drank water has died, so I'm going to stay away.
Dihydrogen monoxide strikes again.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
Oh,
no. Listen, there's a common thread that no one's talking about,
that's
and it's water.
Very good point. New Wi-Fi data shows that I know that Peloton. Right, the data streamed to at-home fitness bikes was down 23% in the first half of 2022.
That's interesting.
We're all leaving the house again.
We're going back to the gym, maybe, huh? Fitness bikes, the single biggest contraction, followed by Blu-ray players, iPods, and similar devices.
I don't think that.
iPods.
Again. Just media players was the whole category. Declined 14%. This is the data streaming via Wi-Fi. This comes from Plume.
Blu-ray players stream Wi-Fi? They don't have enough. That doesn't make any sense.
Some of them are streaming boxes.
Media players. Media players.
We're picking the sentence apart, Leo. I'm sorry.
I didn't write this.
We're coming for you.
Yanko Rutgers wrote this on Protocol.
Who's watching these Blu-rays?
PCs were down 7% year over year. This is because Plume, which makes those little pods that Comcast uses, a number of companies also use for their mesh Wi-Fi. And of course, you can buy them directly. Smart TVs, data consumption increased by 34%. Smart speakers, and I think I'm mostly responsible for this, up 27%.
I was going to say, you have 18 in every room in your house.
And they're all sending every conversation, of course. So up 27%.
Every cough, every shower you take.
I'm now highly concerned about this Plume group here, this data.
Yeah, I was going to say, Plume is just selling data left and right.
It's anonymized.
They're in the house of every person that owns an iPod still.
Yeah,
you know?
It's anonymized. Yeah, all the iPods.
Maybe a non-representative sample, honestly, if they're all iPods and Blu-ray players.
I think it's media things, and they broke it down to Blu-ray players, iPods, and similar devices, but I think media players shouldn't leave
I
with
think
Blu-ray
it's streamers.
Players.
I think it's Apple TV
streaming
and
box.
All that stuff.
Roku's, Apple TV's. Yeah.
I hope it is.
This is an unpopular opinion, but I want my TVs to be dumb. I still have my TV 5 years ago, and I'm like, I don't want you to connect to the internet.
No.
I'll plug my Roku in and out as I see fit and nothing more.
Exactly.
We got a smart TV. Because we wanted a bigger TV during pandemic. We were like, oh, let's get a bigger TV. We're watching it more. Needs something to watch. And so we did, and I got a Vizio, and the great part is not only that it's smart and that I have to deal with its stuff, is at some point in the last few months, it developed this new firmware update that I can't figure out how to control, where when the video source gets turned off, like the Apple TV, if the HDMI CEC thing doesn't work and your TV gets turned off also, then the TV just starts advertising itself. It starts putting up movies and stuff you can buy through the smart TV part. And I'm like, I did not buy you so you could advertise to me in your downtime. That is not the
This is the Kindlefication of everything. It's just like, oh, you have a blank screen? Let me throw some ads up there. TV nothing you can do to offers. Stop it. Try.
Yeah, I paid full price. There's no special offer there. That's right. I paid full price for that puppy, but pretty cheap. We all know the video monitor companies, TV companies are, I think a few years ago, it turned out that most of them weren't making any money. I think Samsung, only the ones that made their own displays, their own panels were. So they have to make money somehow. They're skimming it off the top.
Yeah. I'm writing down the Kindlefication of everything. I will use that somewhere. That's good. I like
thank
it.
You. Just whenever you put that in the hat.
Paris, when you disconnect here, there'll be an ad replacing you on the screen.
Yeah. It'll like just be, minutes. You know, like a little emoji, but it'll just say, like, buy Apple products.
One of the things, apparently, and this is contrary to Johnny Ive's long instructions, Gurman says the iPhone 14 Pro models will have bigger batteries. Woohoo.
Okay, wait, why is that what Johnny Ive was against?
He liked thinner, lighter.
Okay, I know, but a worse performing phone?
Well, yes, and this is why I'm glad Sir
batteries
Johnny...
Batteries were inelegant. That was the problem.
Yes. Batteries were inelegant.
Being able to use your phone for more than 8 hours a day is really inelegant.
I agree.
No.
This is going to end up being controversial. I predict the new iPhone cutouts will be a lozenge and a pill, but... And this is the thing I think is going to be controversial. Apple's going to darken the screen between the lozenge and the pill.
I saw this.
And that's where it will do simulated lights for if your camera's on or your microphone's on, so that it will look like a big lozenge, except it won't be. The cutouts aren't, but the screen is going to just extend that. And then what happens to this wedge above? What happens to this border up here? Just thrown away? Just useless? You can't put anything up there?
Up there is just going to be where it keeps saying like 5G plus plus plus.
No,
like
no,
best service ever. And meanwhile, you have like one.
It's going to be here. Yeah.
Yeah. We've changed the bar system. It's no longer 5 bars. It's 25 small bars.
It's 25 small bars and like 7 star symbols.
It's a bar crawl now. You're going to go to 25 bars. It's just 5 bars.
Okay.
And you're still not going to be able to make a video call if you're not connected to Wi-Fi.
Okay. Let's see what else. Oh, the AirPod 2. Now, AirPods are a product I am not, I have to admit, really covering.
I'm rocking some AirPods.
Are you? Are you? You like your AirPods? Oh, yeah.
I love my AirPods just because I enjoy being in as close to silence as possible.
They're the number one choice of contributors on CNN, I believe.
A very hot market. Yeah.
I see them all the time. And you can't miss it because it's a big white thing in your ear.
And all of them have like the same buzz cut, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of
Yeah. The AirPod 2 will have, you'll appreciate this. The pros have noise cancellation. The AirPod 2 is going to.
I've got pros.
Yeah. These are going to sound better because the rumor is, and I hope this is true, because Apple's been usually kind of laggard in Bluetooth.
Oh, the sound quality is awful.
It's terrible.
I'm using these just for audio in, but I have my big mic for audio.
Yeah, don't listen to music.
Don't use them for a mic, absolutely. Yeah. The sound quality into your ear is pretty solid.
I use them for the mic, a podcast, and that's about it.
This
for
is,
listening
this
to.
Is that thing. I used to get so much email about Bluetooth stuff at Macworld, and a few years ago when I was doing an editing stint at Wirecutter, we wrote kind of a fact about people always like, why is Bluetooth...
So bad.
Like, well, and I actually contacted the Bluetooth SIG, and they were kind of like, well, it is bad because, and I was like, wait, what are you, why are you agreeing? There's a very particular scenario that Bluetooth weirdly wasn't prepared for, which was streaming high quality audio in both directions in like certain circumstances. So like over Bluetooth LE, Bluetooth 4 LE, if you, the low power version, low energy, you can be using the wrong profile. So if you have the right device and the right profiles, it'll sound great. Then you will walk to a different device or even a different model of the same device, like an older MacBook, and you sound like you're coming in on an old radio, you know, show from the 1950s or something.
It's strange. Also, Bluetooth, I don't know if you guys have noticed this when walking around in large cities, but here in New York, Bluetooth has always really craps out when you're walking across like an avenue or something.
What?
Even if your phone is in your pocket,
really?
I will say like one out of five times will cut in and out. And I had a colleague who looked into this and wrote an article that I'm now forgetting the details of course. But I think it's because there are so many different signals
and
crossing off the same path that it ends up having
you're crossing
issues.
You mean with like at a crosswalk and a bunch of people with you crossing or just...
Even if you're by yourself, like just because there is a lot happening in this space.
Well, but Bluetooth uses, let's thank Hedy Lamarr, actress Hedy Lamarr, for Bluetooth frequency hopping.
Spread spectrum.
Yes, it still uses frequency hopping. So it should actually be more resilient than anything else because it swaps among like 80 something frequencies on a pattern basis. But that's,
I think in like high density locations, it gets a bit confused.
Too much reflection. Yeah.
Honestly,
there's a lot of reflection going on.
I think there's a great gulf between the spec and the results on all of this stuff. And Apple will have the new H chip, the H3, I guess. It will be in these new AirPods. And it is hoped by some that they will in fact upgrade the Bluetooth LE spec to use LC3, which is a much higher quality codec.
Definitely a better.
Google's
I mean, I've got the
studio.
the Beats Studio Buds, and they are absolutely rock solid for audio playback, and the audio input is terrible. I mean, it's I don't think it's the mic quality. I think it's simply the standard.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's
I will say the one thing about these AirPods Pro, which I guess is like a recent software update that I absolutely love and wish would come to other devices that I have, like I have over-the-ear Bose headphones, is with Apple's Find My app.
Yeah.
I lose everything always. So literally before we were recording this, I was like, where did I put my AirPods? And you can just open it up and it will tell you like, you're not close. And then you walk over to the other side of your house and you're like, you're closer. And then it's like, it's 5 feet to your right and 1 foot down. And you can find them like that.
You're never more than 10 feet from a pair of AirPods.
Yeah. I mean, you know, every person ingests about 3.1.
Yeah, if you've got them in your tummy, you're right next to them. I have AirTags on my keys, but it does. The problem is you have to be near them or it says I can't. I don't know where they are.
And well, no, you should be able to.
No, it won't.
Other devices. Oh, you want the very short range. The ultra precise finding.
I want to find my keys. It's a very simple.
Why don't you just play the sound on them? Why don't you just play?
You can't unless they're.
No,
I've tried. It says
something's terribly wrong. Then
I lost my keys this morning, and it said we can't. You have to get closer to your keys for us to play a sound on them.
Oh, that's right. It's Bluetooth range for keys.
That's right.
But it should be able to find them when you're.
Has no idea. It says it's.
It'll
in the
show
house.
You like near or far.
They're in the house. They're in the house,
but, you can't, it doesn't
but I know they're in the house. That's not the problem. It's where in the house.
Leo, you shouldn't have built your house as a Faraday cage that blocks all signals.
My house is a single story, so it's spread out.
That's
and
so funny,
I think
though.
Honestly, so what I have to do and what I did this morning is wander all around the house until it says, "Oh, I see him now," and then it'll play a sound.
I see,
Leo. You know what you need to do with you and your 87 phones, the ones that are iPhones, you should hide one in each room.
Oh, that's
and then
idea.
Connect it in the cloud so that you're
network.
Never you have one iPhone within every room to find your keys.
No, there's always an iPhone within 10 feet. I wrote a book about AirTags and Find My, of course, because I've written a book about everything now. And
is it a take control book or
it's a take control of AirTags and Find My or Find
okay,
My?
Okay, I might have to buy this.
And it's but it's fun. I mean, how do you write a book, 120 page book about it? It turns out to be easy because there's so much complexity. But recently, my wife, who is we call my wife the early rejector in the house, and I use that with affection. She doesn't want to adopt new technology before it's matured enough. And you know, I'm the person always. Testing everything out. And so the other day she said she got lost in a parking garage I've been lost in as well because there's multiple floors you can't get to from each other. So she'd parked in one of them, gone up an elevator, and then taken the elevator down to a different part that's non-contiguous. And she's like, all right, can I get an AirTag for the car? And she has a car she drives more often than I do. But then when my older son and I drive that car, we're like, there's an AirTag moving with you. He's like, what? Oh, it's
Oh, Lynn's, I hate
Lynn's,
that.
Lynn's tracking us.
Yeah, you know what? This book, 130 pages, it should be longer. Should be longer. Make it longer.
Yeah, there's a lot of privacy stuff. And
all right. I need
honestly,
more.
The one thing something. I wish AirTags could do, which I don't know why they haven't instituted this feature, is if you, let's say, like I was on a trip the other week, and I had my AirTag in my keys in like a carry-on that I left at the hotel while I was out and about, like in a storage thing. And I was like, oh, I'd love it. Shouldn't I be able to turn on a setting that if my bag is moved, if my AirTag is moved from this location, it gives me an alert? You can't do that for some reason, and you should be able to do that.
Oh,
that
but it's
is
an anti-stalking
basic command.
It's
I know,
an anti-stalking problem. It's a two-edged. I know. It's funny. Somebody was just asking me the other day. They're like, exactly that. I left my luggage in my hotel room. Why can't I mark it? So when it moves, it's like because the small percentage of people are ruining it for all the rest of us are going to use that as a tool to track people. But there should be a consent thing. There should be a way to say, I'm going to do this, but it's also going to, every time it does it, it's going to put out an alert immediately to everybody around you as opposed to a moving with you thing. I mean, there should be ways to make it more... it should be able to announce itself more that it's doing it while still keeping you, your device or your stuff safe.
Absolutely.
Apple will not be announcing an AR or VR headset on Wednesday. Mm. We're pretty sure of that. Although there were rumors they would do a VR headset this year. Mark Gurman's now saying next year. But they did file a trademark for This is filed by Immersive Health Solutions, LLC in Wilmington, Delaware, which it turns out is an Apple shell corporation, for a trademark for Reality One. So Reality, and maybe they're going to call AR Apple Reality, right? Reality One and Reality
Apple
Pro have been
and
trademarked.
Facebook Meta, I guess, are just really going as broad as possible with these names.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard. What are you going to call? I mean, Google Glass, Apple Reality. I don't know. It's hard to brand.
I mean, just how do you trademark the word reality? That's my question. Like,
well,
how are
apparently you do. And over
apparently you can.
In that old world, we're just living in it.
In several countries over the past few weeks, including the U.S., they also trademarked Reality Processor. So that would be the onboard.
It's called our brains, the reality processor.
That will handle the
Apple brain. It's yet to be trademarked.
So, what's your thoughts? I mean, are you waiting with bated breath for a Apple VR AR headset, or
I want to be convinced that I want it. That's the thing for me. I mean, I've used a little bit of VR stuff in the past. Apple's been talking a good AR game for a long time, but I've always thought that the demos they've done in their product demonstrations before are, they don't really represent what's so great about it. Like, because they'll be up on the stage with the phone or the iPad and they'll be pointing it at a table and like, look, this is amazing. The reality has been all augmented. But like, fundamentally, a phone and a tablet are not a good way to experience this, because it's like peeping through a peephole. Like, look into the immersive world, but you have to hold this thing of glass in front of you in order to peek through. Whereas, you know, obviously a headset seems like a much better proposition for that. So they've laid a lot of groundwork for it, which is encouraging, but it's a hard sell. I mean, I think Google learned this
honestly,
a decade ago. You know.
Glasses are the ideal format, and I don't think we're ready for glasses, because you want something that's inobtrusive, doesn't look like Google Glass. I know somebody on Twitter was pointing out, it was only a few years ago that people were literally beating people in the street for wearing Google glasses. I'm like, yeah, it was kind of crazy. People got so mad about the feeling of invasiveness by them and the way that people who had early Google glasses were using them without kind of exercising.
Have we changed enough as a society in the intervening time? I mean, everybody's got a camera on their phone, or four different cameras on their phone. I mean, are we used to that?
I mean, no one's beating people up for wearing those Facebook Ray-Bans.
Good point.
The snap.
That's the same thing. Or the Snapchat glasses.
But I think once they're inobtrusive enough, if they're just a layer that is barely visible.
Yeah, what if you were wearing them right now, Glenn, and on your existing spectacles? If you
just joining us sunglasses on for the entire
English.
You know?
I don't speak English. This is being translated live
a
and heads put up on my glasses.
It could be a heads up display on those glasses. It would be. Do you think? I guess they'd have to have a bigger battery. They'd have to have.
But that's the goal. Clearly,
I will say. I mean, the thing is, over the past over the past month, I've had my just randomly thinking while I was doing stuff. I was like, man, it would be really nice to have a heads-up display that somehow did work with either eye movements or maybe a voice component. Where you're like washing the dishes and you're like, oh man, I wanted to like. I can't remember the name of that one thing I'm thinking of, and I don't want to have to dry my hands to look it up.
The
that
switch
would be great,
is
but
between
I think
his legs, Paris. Between his.
I know. Yeah. I always forget that. But
I'm
the thing
sorry,
is,
that's
I mean,
rude.
I think
I
there
apologize.
Were a while. No, listen, sometimes you got to look it up.
It's a callback,
The thing is, I think that we're a long ways away from making that work, like technologically.
I don't feel
speaking.
Like anybody wants this, that this is the tech industry saying, we need the next iPhone. What is it going to be? And that's the best
thing. That's
how
I feel about some of the VR stuff right now. Yeah. I think that AR could have very interesting real world applications that would be very useful. But I think that full VR right now is just too uncanny valley, and it doesn't seem like there are that many use cases for it.
Yeah.
In the AR side of things, I think you got to remember, it's not like someone's going to come out and, you know, hand you that pair of spectacles that looks totally unobtrusive, right? That's not the first gen product. No one's going to be.
Right.
And we perfected
all
it already.
Like Tron.
Right? Yeah, it's going to, if there's something there, it's going to take a whole bunch of iteration to get to that point. I think that's the ultimate goal, but it's going to be messy and ugly for a while from, you know, not everything is the original smartphone.
That might be enough to kill it, right? I mean, look what
it could be.
You looked so dorky on a Segway that it was it. It was over. It was like, yeah, that's not going anywhere.
I mean, here's the thing that I think is a good example of how it would work, though, is, you know, an iPhone, as awkward as it is to hold an iPhone up for augmented reality, it can work incredibly well. And for things like translation, right? That's the perfect use case.
Right.
You hold it up and Google Translate and other apps will do that live translation thing on signage or subtitles or whatever.
Menus.
And that's great. I mean, we're not always traveling. So, or offering live captioning. If you had AI, you know, if you had Siri live caption, Skype, whatever system, Google.
But nobody wants to hold up a phone all the time.
Yeah. Right. And it works.
It depersonalizes you from like, okay, I'm staring, Glenn, I'm talking to you, but I'm looking at my phone while I'm talking
but it's
to
a,
you.
I mean, it's a worthwhile use case, but the form factor's wrong in most cases.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Agreed.
Right. Let's take a break. More to come. Our fabulous panel. Our show today brought to you by Zapier. I use Zapier all the time. In fact, it's how we produce the shows. Zapier is automation done right. If you're trying to grow a business, you know your time is precious. And what if you could streamline the boring stuff, the routine operations that eat up your time? Things like lead management, employee onboarding, customer support. That's what Zapier does. That's what's awesome about Zapier. It makes it easy to connect all the apps you use, to automate routine tasks, to streamline your processes so you got more time to do the stuff you're good at, customer and client needs, that kind of thing. It's the power of automation made possible for everyone. For instance, when I am going through my news feeds, my RSS feeds, I have a Zapier script. If I click a link or a star of news feed, it automatically zaps it. It puts it up on my Twitch social feed. I have a news feed there. It puts it onto Pinboard, and it even adds it to a spreadsheet called Leo's Links that can easily be moved into a rundown spreadsheet. It all does that. I don't even have to think about it. I set this Zap up years ago, and we've been using it ever since as a big part of our production, and it saves me so much time. I don't even have to. It's kind of, if I thought about it, I figure it's probably saving me hours every week, hundreds of hours every year. That's kind of mind-boggling, and it was so easy to set up. I use Zapier for all kinds of automation. And if you're in business, what a great way to get started with business automation. This is not low code. This is no code, zero coding. There are 4,000 apps that Zapier connects with. The most popular business apps out there, Google Sheets. I mentioned that. We use that. QuickBooks, Facebook. You have Google Ads, any RSS feed. You can automate almost any workflow imaginable with easy-to-use templates, thousands of them right on the site. You don't even have to write your own a lot of the times. And once you get good at it, the sky's the limit. The average user saves over $10,000 in recovered time every year. I guess that's accurate. If it's 200 hours a month for me, that's 1,000 hours a year or more. Yeah. Yeah, I get paid more than 10 bucks an hour. No wonder over 1.8 million people and businesses use Zapier to streamline their work and find more time for what matters most. I've been a Zapier subscriber for, I think, as long as they've been around, for years and years. See for yourself why teams at Airtable and Dropbox and HubSpot and Zendesk, thousands of other companies, including Twit, use Zapier every day to automate their businesses. Try Zapier free today. Z-A-P-I-E-R, Zapier. I love the name. They call the program Zaps. Zapier.com/twit. Thank you, Zapier, for supporting the show and, I mean, literally streamlining my workflow. Let them streamline yours. Try it free. Zapier.com/twit. Don't forget the slash twit. That's very important. So they know you saw it here. We were talking before the show about Adam Neumann, the guy who started WeWork and then, kind of drove it to the ground, but walked away with a lot of money. He got bought out by SoftBank. Now he's buying.
The definition of failing up.
Failing up is right. He's now buying.
Now getting more money.
Apartments. And Andreessen Horowitz just gave him $350 million, but that's not the news story. The news story is my friend Kevin Rose getting $50 million for his Moonbirds NFTs, a $50 million funding round for the Proof Collective. Now, I have to point out, Kevin actually already made $50 million selling these Moonbirds as NFTs. They made so much money that he had to make a YouTube video saying, we're going to do something really good with this with this money.
That's always a sign.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, the rich get richer. And, you know, I love Kevin, so I'm glad he's getting the money. The Proof Collective will get $50 million not only from A16Z, but also from Alexis Ohanian's VC firm, 776. What's with the numbers on these things? I had a $10 million funding round in April. Great, I guess.
Here's my pitch. I think, you know, everybody, instead of investing all this money in NFTs, should give me their $50 million.
Yes,
and
sure.
I, in return,
what will we get? Will we get a sequin mannequin
everybody,
butt?
I will. Okay, let's say, you know, instead of your NFTs, you can get a very bespoke, collectible, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to own a piece of a mannequin butt that there's only
Perfect.
One of in the world.
Perfect.
And it's encoded in this blockchain called Reality, which, albeit, has been copyrighted by Apple, so we might have to work around that.
Good point.
But there's only one of them, so, you know, it's going to be a real collector's object.
I
would like to buy one art...
Go ahead.
One art.
Go ahead, Glenn. What do you want to buy?
I would like to buy one art, please.
Please, give me
That's
art.
A Futurama reference for those who
Yes.
Can.
Yes. How about you? What do you think, Dan?
I think $50 million buys a lot of copies of my book, so we'll just want to do that.
That's a good, best seller.
How about the four of us split 50 mil? We call it even.
Yeah, there we go.
I think that's good. I think, you know.
I agree.
NFTs are the biggest hammer that's ever been developed in technology with no nails. There are no nails.
I think almost blockchain is that. I know everybody says, oh, the technology is really interesting, but it's just a distributed database. That's really what it is. It's not.
Blockchain. Leo, so many people are screaming at their phones. Yeah. They're throwing them across the wall. You got to stop this.
I can see a purpose for a blockchain, and I think we will have them. I think we will have a version of fiat currency, of government-backed currency. You know, China's already working on the digital renminbi, and we're going to have a version of it in America, and there'll be a version of the EU and the euro and so forth that uses blockchain technology. And it may be an incredibly bad idea, but I think it will happen, and I think it will be.
Why does blockchain make it better? What makes that better?
There is a utility in having an of an auditable, irreversible, permanent, cryptographically verifiable record of things. But the number of cases in which that's useful compared to a database are very small.
And there's a high price.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it.
Right.
There's a significant price in terms of transaction costs, transaction
Privacy.
Time,
oh, yeah.
and energy usage to doing it this way. So you better damn well have a good reason for it other than blockchain.
I don't know, Leo, but those monkeys are real cool looking. I think that's a great
Proof is also creating a Moonbirds DAO, which will oversee licensing of the Moonbirds name by granting trademark rights and deploying capital to projects that, quote, further the Moonbirds mission. I'm glad they have a mission. The DAO will control a soon-to-be-formed DAO treasury.
Quick question. Are we sending these birds to the moon? Do the birds come from the moon?
Are they already there?
The relationship
no moon
of the
involved.
Birds the moon? I'm not clear on this.
I don't know what their mission is.
Or is the moon like an aspirational goal? Like the birds to the moon spiritually?
I love that.
They're owls.
The birds to the moon.
They're owls. That's all. They're just owls. Monkeys.
They're
owls. Monkeys were taken. So they're owls.
Aww.
The only DAO I invest in is Georgia DAO.
I like Georgia. The DAO stands for a decentralized.
The only DAO I invest in is Ann Dowd, you know, great character actress.
The DAO stands for Decentralized Autonomous Organization, or No, what is it? Now I've forgotten. Wait a minute. Decentralized autonomous organization.
Yeah. It's also kind of a cool idea. A lot of these things are cool ideas, and then the people implementing them make me want to run away into the hills.
They're cool ideas for taking your money out of your wallet and putting it in mine. Proof is also...
At least for a little bit until it gets, you know, hacked and then put in something
else.
That's
true.
But yeah.
That's a good point.
I feel like it's all implementation, though. I mean, we've... Oh,
I was going to say something completely irrelevant. Please continue.
this may be, but we've all talked about Web3 is going great. You know, my favorite site of the last few months.
Yeah.
And it's just this, it's the kazoo playing at the ongoing funeral that people refuse to accept is a funeral for cryptocurrency and DAOs and NFTs. But I think there's a fundamental problem. It's not that the technology is bad, it's that everyone involved in it immediately went into the sort of grifting and churn and hype mode. So you can't take anything that's going on right now, I think, and build something meaningful because there is so much bad that's happening.
Here's an example. Bill Murray auctioned off an NFT representing the right to drink a beer with him, during which a painter will paint a picture of the scene that the buyer can keep. The auction, it benefits a charity, Chive Charities, a veterans and first responder-focused nonprofit. The NFT sold for 119.2 ETH. That's $185,000, give or take. Hours after the auction, a hacker gained access to Murray's crypto wallet and snagged the ETH for themselves.
Oh, my God.
They also attempted to steal 800 NFTs from the remaining collection by Bill Murray, although a wallet security team was able to safeguard those NFTs in time.
What I love about this is, like, everybody compares these things to gold rushes, but what I love about it is this is the grift rush, right? And it's just like everybody constantly stealing from each other. It's kind of hilarious from the outside, anyway.
From the outside, and that's the key. Stay on the outside, baby. Stay on the outside.
Speaking of which, one person who's doing quite well is, I don't know if you guys saw the story that crypto.com accidentally sent a woman $10 million. Fiat, but instead of 100. And they didn't notice for months. And she bought a mansion because it just, you know, if I was to accidentally get $10 million and not have anybody follow up for months, I would, I'd be into
bank
that.
Error in your favor, as the old card says.
They sent, a woman asked for $100 Australian refund. They sent her $10.5 million instead because instead of entering the amount of the refund, somebody at crypto.com accidentally entered an account number into the refund amount section, which, you know, turned out that account number was effectively $10.5 million Australian dollars. Now, I have to say, she's kind of a little bit at fault here. She didn't say, hey, you gave me $10 million. I only wanted $100. She put the money into a joint account with her sister, bought her sister a 5-bedroom house.
That's sweet.
Generous.
Well, now it's in litigation, and crypto.com has to prove that she did something wrong, which is kind of difficult to do.
Yeah, actually, it's an interesting point. I mean,
this happened recently, though, in the mainstream financial market. It was last year.
I was about to say with Citigroup.
The Revlon thing, yeah. Somebody didn't check some compliance box, and they sent, what was it, $400 million?
Citigroup accidentally paid $900 million in debt to Revlon creditors, like their lenders. It was supposed to be just like, a small thing. They accidentally paid the whole debt, and they were like, oopsie, can we have that money back? And they're like, no.
No, you owed it to us.
Yeah,
they got like $400 or $500 million back, and the remaining companies that didn't want to return it went to court, and the judge said, "Well, based on the doctrine of finders keepsers and no backsies,
really?
I don't know.
Really? That's a legal doctrine. Huh? Okay,
it was a legal doctrine that effect. The judge analyzed the terms of the transfer, and it didn't matter that it was an error because the creditors had every reason to believe it was a legitimate
they were owed
transaction.
The money. Yeah,
they were owed the money; it was spent to them. So I think half the creditors did not agree to return it. And it's a very funny, long-running.
It's always hilarious when you see just how fragile the underpinnings of our society actually is. Right, just one wrong checkbox, and the whole thing comes crashing down.
This was two random dudes, I believe, like overseas, whose job was to put some numbers in a box, and like one of them put the wrong numbers and the other one didn't catch it. That's it. Almost $1 billion.
If you missed out on the original Moonbirds, there's a early 2023 Moonbird Mythics.
Oh, thank God.
A profile picture collection of 20,000 NFTs with, quote, an eye toward giving back to the original Moonbirds and Oddities collectors.
I still don't know what any of those words
what
mean.
Is, okay, what is the hearth of an odd god? Okay, I'm just going to read this sentence, scroll up a little bit please. For a second, because there was a really good one
there.
Okay, here? The hearth of the odd god. When an egg enters the hearth, it will hatch 24 hours later. What does that mean?
You
That's
can
the
hatch.
Answer to the
you
question,
can, you can
how
hatch.
Do you get a mythic with an oddity?
You can hatch it. You can hatch it. Only 25 oddities will be burned each day.
Oh, sure.
What?
Sure. If
what?
Someone started saying what? Those words to me, I'd assume I was having a stroke.
So, you know what breaks my heart?
It was like
the artist,
grandparents.
The artist who paints these.
Yeah.
Same thing with the Yuga Labs Bored Apes. Yeah, they get paid like a flat fee.
So yeah, they don't get any of this
any
money
of this.
From the actual trades.
Yeah.
But they also don't have no exposure, like, so it feels like you walk away with at least you got paid in probably real money.
Yeah, maybe? A couple hundred bucks. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, well,
this is how I feel like my grandparents felt when I tried to explain the internet to them. You know, they're just like, there's no context for it. It doesn't make any sense. There's no, it's all abstract, but it's like, I mean, the part is of the internet turned out to be useful. No, that might be a mistake. Maybe I was wrong on that part, where NFTs are definitely not, but maybe the jury's still out.
I'm sure if I got Kevin on, he would have a explanation for why this is good and valuable and true and
sure.
And all that.
It's unlicensed securities trading, you
that's,
know, it's
that's I'm afraid what the SEC is going to decide,
but without any of the rules or regulations.
What you're telling me is
and I guess if you're really into that and making money,
it's good for
that's
making
good
money
for you.
Good for
but
making money.
I don't think that it's a net good to the world.
It's the multi-billion-dollar version of the two kids I saw today on the bike path near my house selling Pokemon cards.
Oh, nice!
At their table, I think that's basically
future.
Future NFT crypto
NFT
traders.
Crypto.
Yeah, you just got to walk up to those kids and be like, so have you heard about the blockchain?
Yeah.
This would be much better.
Get out now.
Yeah.
Get out now. It's too.
They'll call their parents immediately.
Yeah.
Somebody in the chat room saying, well, bring Kevin on. Nope. Not going to do it. I've already told staff and producers, and I'm sorry if you're all into this stuff. Nobody who's going to come on any of our shows who's going to flog NFTs, flog cryptocurrency. I'm washing my hands of it because, you know what? I don't want to be responsible if you go out and bet your rent money on an NFT thinking you're going to make all this money and it just lines the pocket of somebody who's already got it.
But Leo, what about an algorithmic stable coin? It's got the word stable in it. Doesn't
it's stable.
That
it's
got
to be good unless it collapses.
I mean, there's nothing that's ever gone wrong with those before, right?
Oh, Lord. I like Kevin a lot. I can't say I endorse what he's doing with this. And he, you know what? They're going to say, well, that's just because you're old and you don't understand it. You're like Larry David. You're a boomer.
You can't even find your keys.
Okay, boomer. Yeah, I can't even find my keys. So
I'm
what do
the
I
bloop,
know?
Bloop. I'm hitting the bloop bloop and the button doesn't go. It doesn't play a sound. What's going on with that?
And his garage door has opened and closed about 6-7 times. So that's working great.
I'm logged out of Facebook suddenly.
I'm laughing because it hurts because actually I am that old, but I do a radio show where people who are actually much older than me call in and exactly those questions and I have to go, hey.
Oh, I have a great account to follow. Jessamine West, who is at Jessamine, that's MYN, who's a librarian and a futurist and a great technology thinker. But she's a librarian in Vermont. And one of the greatest people who I think writes and thinks about the future of what information online is, but also is just like a librarian. And she has this regular thing where seniors come in, and people of any age, but often seniors come in, and she helps them with technology, and she tweets it out and with absolute love, right? And it's fascinating to see. I love this insight. This is why I love writing the Mac 911 column at Macworld also.
Yeah. You're doing the same thing. You're doing God's work.
What is hurting people? What is the friction? What doesn't make sense to them? And if I can solve that, I feel great. But I also want to understand how people conceptualize technology. And so she's seeing, you know, people who have not encountered or are using it, are functionally almost illiterate in technology, but they have to use it every day. And they come to her, a librarian, for help.
Anyway, I love it.
She used to live in Seattle.
She calls herself the rural tech geek.
Yeah.
which is easier than saying the rural juror. Jessamine, J-E-S-S-A.
I technically own Metafilter. That's right. She also was, for many years, was one of the main people below Matt Howie.
Oh, I love Matt, and I love Metafilter. Yeah, Matt's, all right. Well,
Matt's great. Yeah, she was a moderator or whatever they call, I don't think they call them moderators. Whatever the name was there, that was.
I still subscribe to Metafilter. It's still active.
It's a very lovely site.
Yes.
They did a great job building a community.
Boy, we've now mentioned Waxy Links and Metafilter.
what year is it?
We are old.
I've been writing about this in my live journal, so everything's...
Suck.com? I don't know what's that.
I miss
Suck.com.
Love
the design of Dig. It's never going to change, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Speaking of Kevin Rose, we kind of got Dig in there as well.
That's right.
Yeah, it all comes around.
That's funny.
And then meanwhile, these youngsters, these whippersnappers, have announced USB 4 version 2.0.
Oh, I got things to say about that.
I knew Glenn would have
things. Guys, I just want one USB to rule them all. There are too many types. We just got to pick one.
I got a back channel to somebody who's involved in these discussions who is very unhappy because of people making fun of this name, but simultaneously also told me that this is an internal product spec version release number, and at some level, the people, the USB Implementers Forum, the USB IF that manages this spec, they have these two parts. One is kind of a public-facing part, and one is a developer and manufacturer-facing part. This press release came from the developer manufacturing part. It's like, hey, it's awesome. We've got version 2.0 of 4.0 of 6.3 of 7 out. And everyone's like, yay, right? And the consumers are like, oh, God, they're giving us new numbers. Is it going to be a trapezoidal connection again or a dodecahedron? Like, what am I going to do?
I need to get new cords.
So he's like, look, when this actually ships, it's going to be called USB 4. And what it's going to say is 80 gigabits per second. And it'll be labeled, and you'll know if your devices are, and it'll all be.
That's such a lie.
It's all going to be straightforward.
No, that's such a lie. That's not true. That's so untrue. They always say this. Oh, don't worry. You get that Type-C cable, there'll be a sigil on it that will tell you what it can do. And then on the port of your computer, there will be a little sigil that will say what it can do. And then you match the two. Nobody puts any of those symbols on anything. You don't know what it does.
The product listing when you buy it will say every word that has ever been made that's associated with technology. It'll be like cord monitor power speed 80 bits 200 extra fast.
High. Extra high ultra speed.
They gotta
fast.
Do what
version 4.20.
If you mismatch your sigils, then you summon a demon. So you get
exactly.
I like the word they use. Sigil there is a good. That's a good $64 word there.
I think that's what they are. They seem to be burning with fire.
As I said, I've written a book on every topic, and I have a book called Take Control of Untangling Connections, and it is in part about understanding.
It's either about cords or about your love life.
Or both.
There's a narrative that runs through it. It's very complicated. She was USB. He was Thunderbolt.
Then he got a sigil emblazoned on his forehead and summoned Antichrist.
No child of mine will ever marry a trapezoidal type B connector.
But this is the book you have to read if you want to get all the answers on how to connect USB, Thunderbolt, Ethernet, DisplayPort, HDMI, and audio.
It was an incredible journey writing this book. But I think the nice part until the announcement of USB 4 version 2.0 was that it seemed like if you have relatively recent devices and they have a USB-C port on it, generally you plug in a Thunderbolt 4/USB 4 cable. That's kind of the new universal cable, and everything works.
You lost me.
All right, let me go back.
There's a slash in there, and the slash on Paris's keyboard doesn't work.
People keep telling me about Thunderbolt, and I'm like, this is too much. Listen, I just want one.
Glenn, you're digging a deeper hole. Cable. I don't think it's getting better. Whatever it is, we'll have 80 gigabits per second of bandwidth, which is, about 100 gigabits more than you'll ever need. But okay, good, frankly, fine.
It's going in the shoebox in the bottom of my drawer with all the other cables.
You can use your old cables, but they won't be as fast.
I did discover the reason you want 40 gigabit per second, and this is, it took, because most things don't need it. You don't have a RAID drive.
A hard drive can't do it, let alone 80.
SSDs, the fastest modern SSDs can actually perform at rates where you're starting to hit above a limit of 20 gigabits per second, which was kind of the earlier high point for USB and Thunderbolt 2, in some forms Thunderbolt 3. So all the current specs are like, okay, we do 40. If you're all up to date, everything does 40. And then the fastest SSD you can buy can perform at its highest internal bus rate. And that's kind of the bottom line. So they're doing 80 because there's a new generation of SSDs that will be out at some point, and you'll want to be able to use those
also,
at full speed for video and whatever.
People will use docks. I mean, I think this is the real reason. With multiple connections, sharing that 80 gigabits, that 80 gigabit port.
I've got a stupidly expensive dock sitting under my monitor, and it pained me to buy it, but... man, it's lovely.
Yeah,
got all my
700 ports on it, or I reviewed.
I mean,
like
because it's
ports.
Like a Mac one, it's not as many. As
it's
I'd
obsolete.
Like,
by
I can't
the way.
Have anything.
Does it do Thunderbolt 4 3.2?
It does do all the Thunderbolts. I don't know. I hate it. I was like,
CalDigit,
I just want one that has like six
I have
USBs.
The, I have
but
the
also
CalDigit.
Two USBs.
I bet she has the CalDigit
and the
CalDigit,
Thunderbolts and an Ethernet.
Yeah,
important. It's like the CalDigit one is like $300, but it has, I think, literally 18 ports coming out of it.
Yeah.
So you plug in the CalDigit. It's a great unit. It's kind of expensive, but it's like it has every kind of USB, Thunderbolt, DisplayPort, HDMI, multiple. It's like if you just want to buy a thing and it answers the need, you throw that thing. That's a tiny one. They have one. It's like the Thunderbolt.
You couldn't get it for a long time. I waited forever to get it.
The thing is, I took a long time looking in this, and I was like, I want one that has at least a cord that like plugs it into my computer that is at least more than 3 inches.
This is it.
Because I put my computer up on a monitor. Yeah, that is, I do have that
one. TS3 Plus.
Plus. Two pluses.
Plus.
It's so good.
It looks like it could be like a small explosive device.
It kind of seems obscene. There's like if you have that what's the thing if you have the fear of holes not just
yeah I think it's like misophilia or
there's a fear of holes.
Yeah, people
have the cameras.
People are,
like on the
holes
cameras
are scaring
on the
people left and right. Yeah.
You can't live in Switzerland if you have this fear. It's very very hard.
I like that. Call those ports because it looks like the old Onion article about we're going to put five blades on the right there. Like put another port on it.
It is. We're
doing all the
ports. But it's
where's
really
my scuzzy port?
It's a really good unit. It's really good. It's got it draws like 140 watts. It's this is the ultimate thing. This is the like the killer dock. If you really
if I
just
need
want
that
to
many ports, I've taken a wrong turn somewhere. I've done something wrong in life.
I need that many ports, and I've taken a lot of
wrong
turns.
Here's the thing. I mean, I waited. I finally got it a couple of months ago. I waited 6 months to get it because they couldn't couldn't get the parts or whatever. And now, thanks to USB, what is it? USB 4 version 2.0. It's obsolete.
Gotta buy a new one. Gotta buy a new one.
Just throw it in the garbage. Throw it in the recycling, electronics recycling bin.
Thanks a bunch, USB. They should do what the Wi-Fi Alliance does. They should just have names instead of all these. Just call it USB for Greased Lightning.
They should name it like they name hurricanes.
Yeah.
It should be like,
Sally.
This is the season of female names.
Yeah.
This is the season of male names. You could be like, screw you, Mike. I want Nina.
This, you mean the Wi-Fi Alliance, the one that introduced the numbering system and then decided to introduce Wi-Fi 6E?
Yeah.
That Wi-Fi Alliance?
That Wi-Fi Alliance.
That Wi-Fi Alliance.
This feels like it's the same people who are naming cell phone like signals.
It's actually, it's one group. It's actually one group of people. Just name everything. The namers.
I'm driving with my
15-year-old. They just have a big bag full of numbers and letters.
Yeah,
and
just pull it out. Like, what is this?
I'm driving with my 15-year-old yesterday, and they're like, I'm not getting good 5G service. What an incredible complaint. And I said, oh, does it say 5G, or does it say 5UG, or does it say 5UW? And they're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, that's right.
Well,
like
let me explain.
AT&T had 5GE, which wasn't 5G. It was LTE posing as 5G.
You, Glenn, did your kid open the door to the car and just roll slowly out as you just...
Seatbelts don't... Yeah.
Is it UC?
Well,
is
like,
it UW?
Working on a seatbelt.
Yeah.
My favorite thing is like now that all the networks have upgraded, like if your cell phone service even goes to like 4G LTE, it's like you're living in the Stone Age. It's like I cannot download a tweet.
It's already
it's like somehow we lived like this.
Yeah. How did we survive? Actually, interestingly, I think this is we'll do one more story, then we'll take a break. But I think this is really I'm happy. Comcast and Charter, says Fast Company, face a grim new reality, actual competition. And where's it coming from? T-Mobile and Verizon's residential internet service using their 5G network.
Verizon Fios, that's what I've got right now.
Yeah.
But I have
not even Fios
internet speed.
Yeah, but that's, you got something, you got a landline good thing. I got this for my daughter. I'm already a Verizon customer, so it's $25 a month. It's just a little Verizon 5G receiver that turns it into Wi-Fi. And it's for residential service. 138 gigs megabits down. It's like 20 or 30 megabits up. It's very good service for $25 a month. And this has stalled Comcast and Charter. Zero growth last quarter.
I love that this is the thing because it's the inverse of like 10 years ago, AT&T had those micro cells, right? You
Went
to Wi-Fi and it gave you phone signal. And now it's like, ha-ha, shoes on the other foot.
My dad and stepmom live in a relatively small town in Washington that has okay cable service. And my dad calls me up. He's reasonably technically savvy in his 80s. He's, for his 80s, he's very technically savvy. And he said, I think the service is going in and out. And we're talking about stuff. And he's like, it just keeps going down and up. And I'm like, have you called the cable company? They get like 100 megabits per second. It's like, yeah, I don't know. I'm like, and he said, then he emails me. He said, I've heard about this new T-Mobile service. Should I get it? I'm like, you know, I've heard good things about it. He orders it. It's $50, including tax. A month, plugs it in, and like I say, they're in a relatively small, you know, not super remote, it's like 2 hours from Seattle with a ferry ride, and he's getting 100 megabits per second.
Exactly.
It's been up like 99.9% of the time. They cancel their 80 something dollar a month cable service because they don't like it, and now they got a thing that works. So.
T-Mobile now has more than a million subscribers.
Wow. Okay.
Half of whom they added in the last quarter. This is Brian Roberts at Comcast said, this is killing
us. Right.
Verizon has 384,000 home internet subscribers, two-thirds of which from the last quarter. It's gone from zero to 60 very, very quickly. Now, I should caution, it will not work everywhere. You have to be close to a 5G tower, that it can't be congestion. If you're lucky enough to have that service nearby, as my daughter is, it works great. It's flawless. I checked. And the other thing is, because I'm the Verizon customer, I can check her bandwidth at any time. So I've been checking it day and night just to see, and it's fine. It never goes down.
What are you doing?
Just
what are you online
thing,
so late?
Day and night, you're like, are
day
you
and night, I'm
video?
Checking. Checking. And
Blu-ray player usage is really down.
Where's your iPod?
Bought three iPods.
No, we have 1 gigabit internet service to our house, and it's because our local telephone company was failing. And so they rolled out, did a big bet the company thing, and they rolled out fiber all over the place.
Good,
so that's
them.
The flip side is I pay 80 something dollars a month for gigabit internet, and Comcast still has terrible, more expensive service in my neighborhood. And so I think they're being killed on that lower end and the higher end.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. Competition's a good thing here. This is
because all the cable monopoly,
$20 a month for 400 up down, and it's fantastic.
What? How is that?
Sweet. Somehow with Verizon, I moved over my phone bill. It like bundled with my home. The home is only $20. Every apartment I move to in New York, I make a Verizon man come up, scale the wall, and drill a hole into my wall to put the fiber thing in. And then I run extension cords throughout my entire home.
Don't
or
show
not
him
Ethernet.
Don't show him the lamp though, because he may never.
I
come
won't.
Back.
You know. Yeah. Last time I think he might have seen one because they accidentally left a fancy router just like sitting on my fire escape. So
nice.
I took it
as they
now
ran.
I have two. That's great.
They
you
ran.
Know? Listen.
All right, let's take a break, and I have the final stories. This is going on way too long, but I'm having way too much fun. Paris Martineau, Glenn Fleischman, so great to have you, Dan Morin. We got to do this again soon. You guys are fantastic. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. Somebody called a radio show today, said, I want to sell online. How should I do the mailing? What kind of printer do I need? Whatever. I said, no. It's very simple. You check with the vendor, see what they tell you to use. If it's stamps.com, you're golden. You don't need a special printer. You don't need anything. Stamps.com is the biggest boon for the small business owner. We're getting ready for the holiday season. It's coming up. If you, I hope you still don't, and I remember this a couple of years ago, going to the post office, standing behind somebody who had an armful of packages she was mailing. She was waiting in line to mail them. That's crazy. Stamps.com can do it all without a trip to the post office. You never have to leave your desk. It's a 24/7 post office you can access anywhere. No lines, no traffic, no hassle. We've been using them since, I don't know when. We've been doing their ads since 2012. I think we've been using them for longer than that. Haven't you tried them yet? You've heard me talk about it. What are you waiting for? And by the way, it's getting better. Stamps.com now is your one-stop shop for all your shipping and mailing needs. For more than 20 years, it's been indispensable for more than a million businesses because they can print real U.S. postage right on the envelope or on a package. But now it's USPS, the United States Postal Service, and UPS together, which means you can you can price shop right there from your desk, get the best deal, get the shipping you need. And nowadays, with inflation on the rise, every dollar counts. Every business needs this. Protect your margins. You'll get major discounts on both Postal Service and UPS rates, up to 86% off. Deals you can't get at the post office. In fact, Stamps.com negotiated a great deal with UPS. There's no residential surcharge. That saves you a huge amount for every package you ship to a home. It's a stress-free solution for every small business. You could print postage wherever you do business. All you need is a computer and a printer. You don't have to get up. You don't have to go to the post office. In fact, if you're using the post office, a uniformed employee of the federal government will come and pick up that mail and take it to the post office, your mail carrier. If you need a package pickup, you could schedule it right through the dashboard. Same with UPS. Rates are constantly changing, but with Stamps.com's switch and save feature, you can easily compare carriers and rates so you know you're getting the best deal. You're saving money. And it's fantastic for an online store. It works seamlessly with all the major shopping carts and marketplaces. They'll actually fill in all the forms automatically. You don't have to do any typing. Print right on the envelope if you're sending an envelope. Print a package label. They'll even suggest, hey, this might be better medium mail. Save some money this way. Look, get ahead of the holiday chaos this year. Get started with Stamps.com. We love it. I can't recommend it more highly. Sign up with the promo code TWIT right now. You'll get a very generous special offer. 4-week trial, free postage, free digital scale, no long-term commitments, no contracts. It's easy. Here's how you do it. Go to Stamps.com. Up in the right-hand corner of the webpage, there's a microphone. It says something like, did you hear this on a podcast or on the radio? That's the one. Click that. See there, up there on the right, and enter the code TWIT. That's it. Then you get the deal. It's the best deal. Don't do the front page deal. Use this offer code. Trust me, it's worth $110. Stamps.com. We love you. Thank you, Stamps.com, for your long support of our network. And you support us, by the way, when you use that offer code TWIT. That's how you let them know that you saw it here. Stamps.com. All right, we got a few quick stories to. Oh, before we do that, I want to wrap it up. But before we do that, I got it. We made this great promo. Thank you, Benito, for reminding me. This is what happened this week on Twit.
Hey there.
Are you trying to connect the sideburns now? Or are they going to actually? Or is that their idea?
I am fully aware. Okay, thank you very much. At least get my profile.
I thought that maybe they'd come to life and they were deciding that they should join up in the middle.
No, they're a team player. My brand is not always on my side, but my sideburns, they're always pulling with the team.
Previously on Twit, Tech News Weekly.
Jason Allen ended up with a first place win in the Colorado State competition. And as you can probably guess, Jason did not paint this picture. The picture were generated by an artificial intelligence engine called Midjourney.
This week in Google.
Start with AB 2273, which passed 33-0 age appropriate design code.
What California is doing is really sort of trying to completely change the way the internet works. And, you know, I think effectively they're sort of trying to turn it into Disneyland, where everything has to be appropriate for children at all times.
Windows Weekly.
And I got on Twitter yesterday, and God damn it, Jensen Harris has come out of a hole in some woods somewhere. He is criticizing the Windows 11 start menu.
Oh!
There is such a lack of self-awareness here. This is like a drunk driver pointing to someone not using their blinkers and saying, that guy's being bad.
Twit.
You destroyed Windows. You destroyed it.
I have some very good news. Paul Thurrott will not be joining the Apple live event stream on Wednesday. It scared the hell out of so many people. you understand why that would be humorous. I don't know if you've ever followed Paul during an Apple event and his tweets. He is not the biggest fan. But I thought, well, that'd be a good antidote to the Apple event. But no, it will be me and Andy Anako this Wednesday. It would have been fun, though. I wish we could have gotten Paul to do it. He said, I don't need the opprobrium. But 10 a.m. Pacific. Yep. 1 p.m. Eastern time. 1700 UTC. Wednesday the 7th for the big Apple infomercial. And Andy and I will give you context. Story of the week. And actually, the headline scared the hell out of me when I saw the picture. Doctor uses his Rivian R1T to perform vasectomy during power outage.
It was a one in a million chance, Doc. A one in a million chance.
I probably, like you, might have misunderstood this story, especially because it looks like that Rivian is crashing into the doctor's office. But no. In fact, a doctor based in Austin, Texas, Dr. Christopher Yang, was set to perform a vasectomy in his clinic when the power went out, as it is wont to do in Austin, Texas. His patient said, "Doc, I can't reschedule. Can we just go ahead and do this?" The doc. Now, you could probably...
I just want to be inside the mind of a patient who's like, "Listen, I know the power's out, but I gotta get this cut. I gotta get this done. I can't wait."
What is the rationale? What is driving this person? Why do they need this?
It's really battery power. Yeah.
I need the backstory.
It's got 314 miles of range. It was plenty close enough to...
So
and then Rivian, you give me a ride, he said.
Like a lot of electric vehicles, has 120 volt AC power outlets, four of them.
Oh my gosh.
On the Rivian. Now, you know, the Ford Lightning, you can actually plug your house into if there's a power outage and run your house off of it. This is not that. This is just regular 120 volt AC outlets. The doc, I guess, I don't know, what did he have to plug in? Lights?
I would think it was his electric cauterizing unit, which I would think would be more like a 220. I mean, that's my opinion as somebody who uses electricity. But
I mean, are you under during this procedure?
No, well, I can fill you in because I've had a vasectomy, and no, you're not. You're wide awake. But you're anesthetized.
It's a local, I hope.
It's a local.
So what sort of a car-powered your vasectomy?
Fortunately, I'll never know. The power didn't go out, and we didn't have electric vehicles way back then. This is actually probably the 28th anniversary of it, because I got it right after my son was born.
You shouted, "Farfugnugan!
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday, vasectomy! Farfugnugan!" They plugged it in. Electrocautery was normal. The procedure went great, says Dr. Yang. I mentioned this story to our own house doctor, our physician in the IRC, Dr. Mom. She said, "That's nuts. If you're getting a procedure and the power goes out, stop. Do not plug into your truck and continue.
Just wait."
Elon Musk probably heard about this and then sat straight up in his bed and was like, "We got to get a Tesla out there performing."
Well, yeah, because there's one thing that Elon Musk did not get. It's a vasectomy.
That's true. He's probably thinks this is a good advertisement.
What's the opposite of that? He did something that's the opposite of that.
He had 10 children.
IVF. He did IVF with his executive to give her twins.
Wait a minute.
Can you do that with
the
Tesla?
Wait a minute. I didn't know this. I remember this, that the woman who runs the neuro brain implant for him is pregnant with his twins. But I didn't understand.
It was through IVF.
They didn't do it in the traditional method.
As far as we know through legal documentation, yes, because they were both able to argue that it was a non-romantic encounter, so it didn't run afoul of HR rules.
By the way, I did not say, and I hope I did not say this, that Rivian vasectomy was nuts, did I? Mm-hmm. No, I hope I did not say that. That would be...
I need a trombone. I need a trombone very quickly.
Because the thing with this story is, no matter how it goes, you're ending up as a news story, right?
Yeah.
One way or another. How it came out, one way or another.
And Sue's doctor over Rivian.
I was about to say, let's check back in with this guy in like a year or two to see if it, you know, actually was successful.
Wow.
Just wait, they're going to do Brisses next. That's going to be...
Oh, Lord.
That's going
to
be...
Inside EVs says the R1T continues to prove its versatility.
I would
agree. The other story I would like to mention, I don't know, maybe this isn't the most exciting story. When I brought this up earlier with another panel, they didn't like it, but I like it. The New York Times says...
Oh, yeah.
We can now talk to naked mole rats. And it turns out the naked mole rat has a fairly elaborate vocabulary. When the two rats meet in a dark tunnel, they exchange a standard salutation. They make a soft chirp and then repeating soft chirp, says Allison Barker, a neuroscientist at the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research in Germany. They have a little conversation. Would you like to hear it? Here you go. From the courtesy of the New York Times. Is my volume turn down. Let me turn it up here. Oh, it's up to you, Benito. We're never going to know what the naked mole rat said.
It's Dr. Wow. Barker is nominative determinism right there, I think. She's studying animal talking.
There it is. That's the two rats talking. The greeting call, which I thought was going to be pretty basic, turns out to be incredibly complicated, said Dr. Barker. Machine learning transformed my research. They're feeding animal sounds to machine learning systems to help them understand what the animals are doing and saying. And in fact, they've been able to see that there are multiple patterns. For instance, not only does each mole rat have its own vocal signature, they don't have any clothes, but they have their own vocal signature. Each colony has its own distinct dialect, which is passed down culturally over generations. And this is the most interesting. During times of social instability, such as in the weeks after a colony's queen is violently deposed, the
Wow.
It's an elaborate
society. We're just going full circle back to Game of Thrones.
Wow. Here. The cohesive dialects fell apart. Then when the new queen begins her reign, a new dialect appears to take hold. I think that's fascinating.
You know what we solved this? Blockchain.
Yeah. Let's throw some blockchain at it.
Throw some blockchain.
Yeah, I know, but can these rats go to the moon? That's the question.
I've been, I love this area. There was an article recently also about the systems that for dog and cat communication. Mary Robinette Cowell, the science fiction writer, on her Instagram, she's been posting updates of talking with her cat Elsie with one of those button-based systems, and it's really, I haven't seen anybody else use it as or document it as publicly or elaborately, and it is extraordinary to see what Elsie will say. And Elsie will just walk across this thing that's full of buttons and not touch one, but like literally just walking like casually across it and then go to the right one and hit the thing or several to express her thoughts. And you're like, there is intent. This is not trained. It's more sophisticated than that. How much is it real communication? It seems like it's fairly substantial, actually, but, you know, we always lay things on top of it.
This is a little cleaner because you're not training the rats. You're just observing them,
exactly.
Right? Yeah. And it's clear that there are a variety of vocalizations. There is University of Washington, up your way, has a software called Deep Squeak. Which
well played, University of Washington. Well
played. It can automatically detect, analyze, and categorize the ultrasonic vocalizations of rodents.
Huh.
It can also distinguish between the complex song-like calls the animals make when they're feeling good and the long, flat ones they make when they're not. You could tell if a rat's depressed. Deep Squeak.
By that description, couldn't anybody?
Yeah.
Well, you really look down in the mouth, Mr. Rat. Deep Squeak has been repurposed for other species, including lemurs and whales.
That's a very deep squeak.
Other teams have developed their own systems for automatically detecting when clucking chickens or squealing pigs are in distress.
Often, it turns out, when people are about to kill them.
Yes.
How are they making
Well, I wonder if we could start to understand the animals, we may not be so likely to kill them, right?
Well, they might have a lot of things to say that we're not very interested in.
Oh, they may be so annoying that we want to kill them? Is that what you're thinking?
You learn a dialect, and you're like, oh, my God, they won't shut up about that new tree, the growth. Although I'd like to talk to crows. I think crows have a lot of interesting things to say.
Yeah. Here's a recording of fruit bats engaged in perch aggression, just in case you're interested.
Are they wearing hats?
I think they're collars, probably. Oh, I also like that it looks like one of those classic 1912, you know, black and white movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was about to say, this looks like Nosferatu is going to pop out on stage, right?
So apparently...
I said, why are you stealing the middle seat? Those armrests are mine.
No, that's exactly...
like, perform a vasectomy. No, the power is out.
Apparently, fruit bats fight for a good position in the colony. And that's what they figured out they were doing. It looked like it. And that, in fact, that's what they were doing. Project SETI, the Cetacean Translation Initiative, CETI, bringing together machine learning experts, machine biology.
Somebody should,
we need a machine to understand me. Learning experts, machine biologists, roboticists, linguists, and cryptographers to detect what whales are saying to one another. I think this is a very... You want to hear some whales? Sure, why not?
Yeah.
I think this is a very... It's clicking. This is a really, to me, a very interesting application of machine learning. Figure out what this is, what they're saying to each other.
I love science because there's just like people sitting around being like, what are whales saying? And they get to figure it out.
Yeah. And then, in theory, talk to the animals.
That's the slight, that's where there's a thin line between science and drug use.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're just like, man, just what do you think whales are talking about, man?
According to the New York Times, the prospect of ongoing two-way dialogue with other species remains unknown. But true conversations will require a number of prerequisites, including matching intelligence types, compatible sensory systems, and crucially, a shared desire to chat.
Maybe the whales don't want to talk to us, and I cannot blame them for that.
There has to be motivation on both sides to want to communicate.
In your TikToks.
Says Natalie Womini, an expert on cognitive evolution. Again, at the Max Planck Institute, but this time for evolutionary anthropology. Max Planck got around. And also, not like Max Elon Planck. Musk. That's a different...
Busy.
That's a different
kind. He was busy in a different fashion.
In a different fashion.
There are two genres, Max Planck and Elon Musk.
Inside all of us, there are two wolves.
Two wolves.
Max Planck
and Elon Musk. It is. They are archetypes for us all.
Wolves.
Mr. Glenn Fleischman, autodidact, Jeopardy contestant, creator of amazing letterpress. What is this here? What is this you're
flong
showing us?
Fancier.
A flong. He's a flong
Seattle,
fancier. Yes.
Some Seattle Star, a newspaper that's been out of business for 70 years. Flong. And a mystery I have.
That's from World War II. MacArthur faces all-out assault.
And the confusing part is this flong is a two-page tabloid-style flong. But on the same purchase, I was able to obtain a full-page... broadsheet flong for that style of newspaper.
Where does one go to acquire flongs?
eBay, but then sometimes things happen, like a guy from Sweden says, hey, I've got a couple hundred pieces of Peanuts flong. You want it?
They just open up their coat and they're like, you want some flong?
Quick question. Do you call those people flong floggers or?
We flog flong. Long flongs. Time no see.
Better explain for those who are not completely up on antiquated newspaper technology what a flong is.
Just got to always show you the flong, not powered by my Rivian. Leo.
It's actually the light switch on my lamp.
that's a good name for it. It's a flong was a mold used in metal type days for when printing was all.
So they poured lead into that mold?
Exactly. They'd make the flong under high pressure from like a laid out page of disparate elements like pieces of type and illustrations. Then they'd put that in a press to create a single sheet that they could then cast into a hemispherical or half circular metal plate that could go on a high speed rotary press and spin really fast and print, you know, vast numbers of newspapers every hour. So in every newspaper in the country, they had dozens of people laying out pages, making flongs, making these plates, putting on presses. It was this incredibly wild amount of lead pouring, and it's a crazy industrial operation that every newspaper had to do until about the 70s or 80s, and then it was utterly thrown out in favor of like a simpler photographic process that everyone uses now.
It's sad though, but thank goodness you're keeping the flong alive.
Little aspects of it in history, documenting it.
Yeah. Glenn, always a pleasure. Glenn F. Dot, or no, I'm sorry, Glenn.fun, two N's.
God, you had, this is your last opportunity.
I know, I screwed it up every single time.
Glenn.
I'm 100%.
Easy to find me, Glenn.fun.
Glenn.fun.
It's in the name.
And there's a lot of good stuff there. So great to see you. Thank you for being
here. Thanks for having me. Great to be
here. Dan Morin, Bayern Agenda, Aleph Extraction, and the newest, the Nova Incident, all part of the Galactic Cold War saga. Great reading. I could vouch for it. Really good. Surprisingly good, really.
Once again, thank you.
Shocked
that a man like you could string a sentence together. Just really, really. I look at you. I see nothing behind those eyes.
It's remarkable. I appreciate it. Sixcolors.com, of course. Anything? What are you going to be doing on Tuesday? Are you going to be doing a live thing or?
Jason will be there at the actual event, so I think he'll be doing some of the heavy lifting, but we'll have some stuff afterwards on the site, and I think we've started doing some like video like wrap-ups afterwards, just sort of quick hit things to sort of discuss, so we might have one of those going up, and there'll be plenty more coverage to come on Six Colors.
Excellent. And of course, the wonderful Paris Martineau, the crafty Paris Martineau, more ways than one, and theinformation.com. There's your signal number. She's at Paris Martineau on the Twitter. What are you working right now? Anything exciting?
I cover Amazon, write about different parts of the business. If you work for Amazon or you used to, come chat with me on Signal. Talk off the record. Be really fun. Kind of like this chat, but also nice. About your work.
Nice.
You covering Amazon's all the unionization stuff, I assume?
Yeah, I mean, that as well as I'm really interested in kind of the movements in healthcare right now, as well as, I mean, I think everything going on with Project Santos, it's a massive company, and I feel like every time I look in a different part of it, I find something more interesting, so.
Always a pleasure. Thanks to all
Always
three of you.
A pleasure.
This was so much fun. I hate to stop. I really do. We do Twit every Sunday about 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC, so you can watch us do it live at live.twit.tv or chat with us live while you're watching at irc.twit.tv. Club members get to chat in our club Discord. If you're not a club member, $7 a month. Let me do a little pitch for this. $7 a month gets you ad-free versions of all the shows. You get access to the Discord, which is always full of fascinating stuff. We do events all the time. In fact, we have a fireside chat coming up September 22nd featuring club Twit members. Stacey Higginbotham's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, Hands on Mac with Micah Sargent, Hands on Windows with Paul Thurrott. There's just a ton of good stuff in there. And all those shows also appear on the Twit Plus feed. So I invite you to join us in the Club Twit. Just go to twit.tv/clubtwit for information. $7 a month. I think it's a good deal, and it helps us out, helps us smooth out the rough edges in the ad world. After the fact, of course, though, we offer on-demand versions, ad-supported, of all of our shows at twit.tv. You can also go to YouTube. Each show has its own YouTube channel, youtube.com/thisweekintech. There's also, of course, the best way to get it, the chance to subscribe in your favorite podcast player. That's free, despite the name. I know it confuses people, but it's free. Just follow us or subscribe to us, and you'll get it the minute it's available. So you have it in time for your Monday morning commute. I hope you don't commute tomorrow because it's Labor Day. Have a great Labor Day weekend. Go out and barbecue. Don't forget, no more white pants or white shoes after tomorrow. This is it. Last chance. Get those shoes on, and we'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye.
Doing the Twit.
Doing the Twit. All right. Doing the Twit, baby. Doing the Twit. All right. Doing the Twit, baby.